So joining us now is Dr. Lee Merritt. Thank you for joining us, Doctor.
Thank you so much for having me.
As we look at this, you know, and right now we have a massive push to push children into taking these vaccines. I mean, tell us what your view is of these vaccines and the protein spike. Is this a vaccine at all?
Well, no. By definition, it's not a vaccine because by their own definition or own understanding, it doesn't stop transmission. You know, a classic vaccine, think smallpox, the idea was I give you the vaccine and you don't get the disease. But this is something totally different. First of all, these are genetic agents. They're not vaccines. They're not made from a little scrap of, you know, of the virus. They're made from synthetic genetic material wrapped in a little lipoprotein coat. And when given to you, it actually is going to produce trillions of copies of the spike protein in your body. So it literally produces what makes people sick and die.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very different. And I've mentioned, let me ask you as a doctor, I mean, the way I've described this, I've said, you know, the whole theory behind a vaccine is you're talking about, you know, smallpox or something like that, is to give you a dead or weakened version of something so that your body can be trained to identify, attack, and destroy it. Except that we're not doing that. What we're doing is we're turning your body into a manufacturing facility, as Moderna and these other people pointed out to Trump when he had his Operation Warp Speed meeting and he went around the table and he had everybody answer the questions and, you know, declining time frame. You know, how long is it going to take you? A year and a half. How long is it going to take you? Well, we can do it in a year. How long is it? Well, we've already got the ability to do this. We just have the bodies manufacture this stuff. So this is very different. You're injecting something genetic to make the body manufacture this, right? So that's not at all like a vaccine, right?
Right, and that's why, you know, it shouldn't be surprising to anybody, least of all these researchers, that some people die from the vaccine, and not an inconsiderable number of people. Now, there's multiple reasons that you can die, but they literally are dying of COVID. Keep in mind that, you know, when it first came, when they had the Pfizer vaccine rolled out into Israel, at a time that 12.5% of Israelis were vaccinated, 51% of all the deaths of COVID were in vaccinated people.
Yeah.
Now that tells you that they're dying of the COVID vaccine. They're also, we see this in, I think it's Malta and Albania. You know, Albania, the death rate of both of those countries started going down to zero towards the end of the summer here. And then Albania stayed at zero because they're not vaccinating people. Malta is one of the most vaccinated nations, and the death rate from COVID is going way back up. You know, it shouldn't be surprising that that's happening because you're overwhelming people's bodies, especially older people. That was what the Israelis found, that if you were over 65, your chance of dying of COVID was 40 times more if you took the vaccine. Because your immune system can't handle it.
That's right.
And it shouldn't be a surprise, but it seems like these guys are surprised by many things.
Well, and as they pointed out, there was a document that was released out of Japan showing that the biodistribution was significant. It went all over the body, that these spike proteins accumulated in organs. And the guy who talked about that, Canadian scientist or medical professional, but he talked about that. So they came after him for talking about that. But you mentioned Albania. I was just talking about a document that showed the non-disclosure agreements that were being demanded by Pfizer with various countries, and Albania was one of them, and they've got guns to all these different countries' heads to hold them harmless, to make them continue to buy the vaccine that they've contracted for, even if they can't deliver it on time, or even if there's another alternative treatment or therapy that comes out that actually cures this, they still have to buy the vaccines. I mean, part of that, I think, is why they continue to push this, but there's also, I think, an element of blackmail of these countries, that you're not going to be, nobody's going to be allowed to travel to or from your country, just as they're locking us down as individuals. They're locking down entire countries, holding a gun to their head and saying, unless you buy our product, nobody's going to go in or out of your country.
It's unbelievable. And they're also demanding sovereign assets from some countries.
Yes, yes.
You know, since when does a pharmaceutical company demand military bases from another country? This mm-hmm. is in, you know, mm-hmm. it tells you what's really going on here. This has nothing to do with a disease. COVID's not a disease. COVID is a takedown. This is an act of war, essentially, against all of us.
It is. It absolutely is. And the other part of this, which you've looked at vaccines over the years and talked about the effects of this, and over the years, we've seen Fauci and the CDC kind of pull the same act each year to try to scare people into getting the flu shot. And now they've got a flu shot that they can compel you to take. What do you think is going to happen in the next couple of weeks in terms of the FDA rubber stamping this and violating their own rules, and then putting this out as corporate coercion?
Well, unfortunately, I'm a little bit depressed now. It looks like it's probably going to go through. But initially, there were FDA regulators that said we're not approving this, which is appropriate. I mean, this is the, you know, if you look at the VAERS report, which is one of the things I've done for America's Frontline Doctors and just on my own. This is the most deadly vaccine program we've ever seen rolled out.
Yes, by a long shot.
By a long shot. Yeah. Just this year alone exceeds all the deaths of all the other vaccines over a 31-year period, mixed, added together.
Yes.
So there is no way that they should be doing this. And, you know, the VAERS, people can criticize the VAERS vaccine adverse event reporting system, but the point of VAERS was to avoid a kind of thalidomide thing where the incidents were too spread out, so nobody saw a pattern. You're supposed to use VAERS to recognize early and unusual patterns. And boy, howdy, do we have that on almost every front. I don't care what diagnosis you pick, brain bleed, myocarditis, tumors. We're seeing an incredible explosion of tumors because we know, and they've admitted this, that to get you to take in these RNA, these genetic agents, which, by the way, we now know the name from because of their shedding document we found, they're called viral-based genetic therapies, VBGTs. That's what they call them. And they know about the shedding. They know about a lot of things, and they just didn't bother to tell us. They just let people suffer. But this whole thing, I mean, they knew about this stuff. It's a huge
smoking gun to see the quantity, as you point out, more than they've come together with all the other previous vaccines for the last 31 years they've been looking at this. Already in 6-7 months, we've had more people that have been identified with this. And, of course, those are people that have reported it, so they would have to verify that. But when it is that order of magnitude, you would think that they would start to, and as you point out, we've got a lot of these things very well documented about myocarditis, about blood clots and so forth. Why won't they stop this? I mean, what types of levels have we seen in the past where they would stop a vaccine? How many people would they need to have? Was it 10? Was it 100? Was it 1,000? Was it 10,000 before they would stop a trial?
Well, and that you mentioned in the past, the European Medical Association in the past from that H1N1 in 2008, keep in mind, those vaccines got pulled off the market after 53 major events. So we're doing 53 a day plus. Probably here. The other issue back then is the EMA was funded by Big Pharma. They changed the definition of a pandemic back then. They used Neil Ferguson to do the modeling. You know, what could be wrong? It's just, you know, what could go wrong here? And then when it fizzled out and they ended up spending all this taxpayer dollars, all these governments spent all these taxpayer dollars buying all these vaccines and antivirals. It killed a bunch of people. It maimed. It gave 700 children in Europe narcolepsy that's intractable and debilitating.
Yes.
So what was their conclusion? Their conclusion is quit taking advice from the people that make money on selling you disease. And what are we doing now? We are doing exactly that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you look at remdesivir and Gilead and that whole sorry story that's come out. But, of course, you know, you're talking about pandemics. And that was Fauci and Slaoui who put that together. And the same pair that's back again. Talk a little bit, tell people what you know about vaccine shedding, because we've got a lot of people who are very concerned about vaccine shedding. If they don't take the vaccine, they're still concerned about what they're going to get from other people. We've seen indications that this is happening. Tell people what you know about vaccine shedding.
Well, it's a real deal, and it's a big deal, because I can tell you what the FDA knew about it. And we kept seeing women specifically would come and complain that their menstrual periods were off, or that older women that were postmenopausal started to bleed, young women that were premenarche shouldn't be bleeding start to bleed, and all sorts of then viral syndromes that crop up.
Oh, we're breaking up. Okay.
Something is coming off vaccinated people. And when we kind of Well, I'm sorry, when we asked for help, of course, what we hear from the FDA was crickets. Okay, but it turns out in 2015, they published a circular to their researchers discussing the issues of shedding. And this is what they say. They say, it seems to happen before 10 weeks, that you should start checking people from day one and do it for 10 days, and then you should do it weekly until you get 3 negative weeks. And it appears they don't think it's airborne. It's by touch, because they want you to check body fluids, okay? Huh. And they think it comes off in 2 pulses, but they don't know when those pulses are. Here's the one I like the most. We don't know if it's a genetic, we don't know what comes off of these, of the vaccinated people. Is it, it's either, maybe it's genetic, maybe it's viral, or maybe it's some kind of recombinant new thing we don't know. So they just let this loose on the world, on all these people, with a potentially Frankenstein recombinant shedding thing that we don't know. And I will tell you, too, when you look at this, and they told you to protect certain people like pregnant women, neonates, elderly, and people with immune compromise. But did they tell us that? Of course not. No. They let a lot of people be damaged, and they pretended they didn't know, but they did know.
Well, it really reminds me, I've seen a lot of people promoting this, and I know some of the people have advocated for it, people like Franklin Graham and stuff. He's like, this is just wonderful, or Al Mohler. This is like the Manhattan Project. And it truly is like the Manhattan Project, where you, where you have Oppenheimer look at it and say, you know, I've now become death or whatever. Or as they're talking about what could possibly happen, if we set off this nuclear bomb, do you think it might set off a chain reaction that would completely burn up the entire atmosphere? I don't know. Let's try it. I mean,
let's try it and see.
We see this over and over again from people. I've talked about this all of my life, what I see in the scientific community and the engineering community, where there's this total disconnect from the consequences, the unknown consequences of something, this recklessness that is there simply because we've got a problem we'd like to solve in the engineering community, the people who are actually doing the science, or the people who are running the whole thing because they got a lot of money they want to make. They don't care. They shut this whole thing down. It's absolutely amazing to see this type of thing happening. So you believe that this, or at least they are saying that it might be associated with touch, and that there is a critical 10-day window after the vaccine. Is that correct? That we could know?
Well, there's probably a 10-week window.
10-week window.
My impression talking to patients, and this is, I think, other people that I've talked to as well, you don't seem to get it by going into the grocery store. You have to have somebody either in your household or you're in a small office where people are vaccinated around you, that kind of thing. Children, I know school nurses were reporting that unvaccinated children were becoming sick when they go back to school and they're surrounded by all these vaccinated people. You know, so I think that's the problem. And here's the other thing that's, I think, one of the potentially biggest, you know, tragedies here. You know, there's all this shaming going on saying, oh, if grandma doesn't get the vaccine, she can't come see the grandchildren. Now, What we know from the Karolinska Institute and various other people is that grandma was never at risk to her grandchildren, because children don't get sick and die from this.
That's right.
They have an immune system that is just on high burn. And vice versa, children don't transmit to grandma because they wipe the thing out so quickly. They're not little fomites. They're not translating this to anybody. They're not giving it off. So that was never a problem. But now grandma gets vaccinated. And what do we discover from the Japanese study that you mentioned? Well, we discovered that this the carrier molecule that was used to put the genetic material in, it is taken up in the ovaries 65 times more than in skeletal muscle. Wow. In other words, it seems to be targeting the ovaries. Now, it's a potential now that grandma takes the vaccine because she's trying to be safe for the grandchildren and the kids demand it. Now she goes over, visits her 10-year-old granddaughter, and renders her sterile for the rest of her life.
Wow.
You see, that is a, and I'm not saying it happens, but this is kind of unknown that should have been worked out before they released this on the world. If we're wrong about this, it's a nightmare.
And we've had a lot of warning about this for a very long time. Dr. Michael Yaden and others have been talking about this. And of course, you know, they were poo-pooed and censored and ridiculed and mocked. But this is the reality of what's happening with us. You mentioned tumors. Now, that's something that I hadn't talked about. I had talked about the fact that when you look at certain viruses and and the relationship to eventually leading to cancer or something like that, because it's taking over the cell, it's taking over its reproduction methodology, and how do you stop this propagation? Is that something that is involved in this? Is why we're starting to see tumors? What are you seeing in terms of tumors now? Because I'm familiar with the blood clots, the myocarditis, right. The other issues. Talk to us about tumors.
Well, let's first say that they had to put some, they admitted that they put code into this RNA or DNA that would dumb down your innate immune system in order for you to accept the genetic agent. That without that, you would just chew it up and it wouldn't work. So they actually put some coding in there to dumb down your innate immune system, which, by the way, we know is if you get COVID and you would not normally have possibly lifetime immunity, you take the vaccine, you wipe out your natural immunity.
Wow.
Well, in part of that, you're wiping out your ability. You know, we all have viruses and we all have tumor genes in our DNA. And now those are becoming expressed. We see people having, you know, shingles break out or different types of viral exanthems, viral rashes break out because they've lost the suppressive, your body's normal suppression of those genes.
That's right.
And that's what also is allowing cancer to break out. Now, I get people periodically, doctors that are getting a conscience from the big universities contact me, and I've heard from a number that they're seeing tumors that they, you know, normally wouldn't see in these numbers. You know, like one person told me that, you know, he normally would see two of this particular kind of lymphoma over, he saw two in 20 years, and he's seen over 20 in the last 6 weeks. I mean, that kind of thing's happening. Wow. And brain tumors.
And the spike crosses the blood-brain barrier, the protein
right,
spike that you're manufacturing.
Does.
Yeah.
Of course it does.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the other thing is, the actual criminality here is there's two populations. It's easy to get lost in the big numbers and all the big population data, but let's just look at two groups. One is there is no moral world in which it's beneficial to vaccinate children with these vaccines because
that's right.
Children just are not at risk, and now you're putting them at risk. We're killing more children than COVID did. And the second group is our military. You know, in 2020, all services combined, they only had 20 deaths from COVID. I mean, the military is young, healthy, robust people. They are not going to go down generally from this. And I told a long, long time ago, I told a retired general, I said, you know, if you don't vaccinate anybody in 3 months, I'll guarantee you you'll still have a standing army. But if you vaccinate everybody, I don't know. And that's what's happening. So now we're vaccinating the entire military, apparently. And we're over like 50%, I think, in the Army and the Navy. We already have had over 80 cases of myocarditis with a 66% five-year mortality. So that means we are killing more people in our military than COVID killed.
And I want to focus on what you just said there, Dr. Mayer. Let me focus on what you just said there, a five-year mortality, because a lot of these people are saying, it's myocarditis. We just bring this healthy 18-year-old football player in. He was in the hospital for several days with a heart attack, but he'll get over it. It'll be fine. No, I said, you know, they're going to have this heart damage forever. I mean, this is like scarlet fever or something like where you have you have your heart damaged as a child. It's going to be with you forever. And you're talking about a five-year mortality rate? Right. 5 year.
And another one is same principle, pulmonary hypertension, which is also fatal eventually. You know, Dr. Huff in Canada has pointed this out. He tested his people that had been vaccinated. And Dr. Huff's a family doctor who works on an indigenous tribal city, basically. And he knows his patients, you know, good old fashioned medicine. And he noticed that they're losing their stamina. Somebody that used to be able to walk 2 miles now can only walk half a block.
Wow.
So he started testing people after the vaccine, and he found that they had what's called a positive D dimer, which is a test that looks for ongoing, not old, but current clotting. So these are people that don't have macro clotting. They're not having big arteries clot like pulmonary embolism or brain clot. These are the microvasculature in your lung and in your heart, and you don't recover that completely. So it's damaging these microvascular, these little clots, and that's going to lead to pulmonary hypertension and other problems.
And
so
that doesn't show up on an MRI, as he pointed out. It's something that only shows up the D-dimer test. And
right.
And I know when I first saw that article, there'd just been a case coming out, I think it was Italy, of a young girl who went in. She immediately got headaches, severe headaches. She goes in the hospital a couple of times, and they don't see anything with any of the scans. And the third time she goes back, it's like, whoa, the massive blood clots everywhere. They send her to an emergency room. She dies within 24 hours, and the surgeon who attended her, who'd been practicing for decades, says, I've never seen anything like these blood clots.
Right.
Yeah, because it got bigger. Right. But even as if they don't get bigger, even if they stay smaller, it's going to have problems with your pulmonary system, cardiac system, right, is what you're saying.
Right. There are multiple stages of potential mortality here, and we are just starting down that road.
And that's the thing, when we look at the other aspect of this, when we look at the VAERS database, when we look at past vaccines and adverse events, it's something that is typically doesn't show up right away. It takes quite a while for it to show up. And that's why the other thing that's so astounding about this, besides the magnitude, it's how early it's manifested itself. Isn't that right?
Oh, yeah. From the beginning. I mean, one of the things that this has in it is polyethylene glycol, which has never been, all of the parts here also are unique. They've never been used in humans before. Mm-hmm. So not only has the whole technology of the RNA or the DNA not been used, also many of the constituents have never been used. And so one of the things we found out right away is that people had 10 times the rate of anaphylaxis, a sudden histamine-mediated allergic reaction to the vaccine that dropped them. We've seen some pictures of those people.
Yeah.
And I know that I got a call the other day from police in Oklahoma that had two people die in a Walgreens or a Walmart pharmacy just within 24 hours getting the injection.
Wow.
And
that's all covered up. That's all poo-pooed and shoved away. It's nothing to, even when it happens immediately. I can understand when you got an actor like Bob Odenkirk and they say, well, it was 4 months ago. He's really healthy. He just had a heart attack. And it's like, that's kind of suspicious, but it was 4 months. When this happens within 24, 48 hours, how do they get away with just pushing this? And of course, it is a vast conspiracy of the media to cover this up and to shut down anybody who talks about it, isn't it?
I know. And, how many people by Christmas of last year knew somebody dead of COVID? In your close family or friends. Mm-hmm. But we all know people now that have died who are family or friends from the vaccine.
Yes.
And I've seen things, Guillain-Barré is ascending paralysis. And as a spine surgeon, I got consulted one day to see somebody that had, they thought she had back pain and leg weakness. But by the time I got to see her, she literally couldn't open her eyes, couldn't open her mouth. And it was Guillain-Barré, very severe, called the locked-in syndrome, when you're mentally there, but you can't move anything. And
oh, my.
It's horrible. And it turned out it started a week after the vaccine. Now, again, I actually studied neurology at the Queen Square Institute in London for 8 weeks. I was in an 800-bed hospital of neurologic patients. That was a disease we read about for our boards and never saw.
Yeah.
And then as the flu vaccine came in to be implemented, we started seeing it, but it still was pretty rare. You'll know a nurse that knew somebody that, took care of somebody in the ICU or whatever. But this was my first really serious case like this that I saw, and I've seen a second one since that. So all of this stuff is becoming magnified. There's no hiding this. It's going to be an avalanche of disaster quite quickly, I think.
Yes. First time I ever heard of Guillain-Barré syndrome was back in the 1970s when we had the swine flu thing and when 60 Minutes was actually doing journalism. And, one of the ladies who was affected by that, was Guillain-Barré syndrome. Is that what was involved? I keep thinking about that lady who was in her late 30s. It was there was an event that's put on by Ron Johnson and a former all-star football player from the Green Bay Packers. And the football player's wife was developed like MS symptoms, multiple sclerosis symptoms from the vaccine immediately. And everybody would shut this down. They started putting together a website where they would tell people's stories, and so he got together with Ron Johnson, and they had an event, and one of these ladies, she was like in her late 30s, she's black, and she had taken the vaccine in a couple of days. Her legs just gave out from under, and she hasn't been able to feel anything in them whatsoever. Is that Guillain-Barré syndrome, or is that something different?
That's probably Guillain-Barré.
Yeah.
It starts in the legs, and then that's why they call it ascending paralysis. It goes up the body sequentially.
So it could get worse.
Unfortunately, this can always get worse.
Now, we've seen, as you pointed out with pandemics, we saw a lot of cases that were horrific about narcolepsy, and I've reported about just how severe that is. People look at it, it's like, oh, okay, you fall asleep. And it's like, no, you fall asleep all the time, and so you can't do anything. You can't drive a car. You can't have any kind of a life. And they've got people, some of the young people who got that, and that showed up, first of all, in the youngest, now in their mid-20s, committing suicide because it's just taken away their entire life. But also they had catalepsy, where you just kind of freeze. And, you know, we've seen that in the stories of Edgar Allan Poe, you know, somebody being afraid they're going to be buried alive because they just don't respond to anything. Is that something that is starting to show up, catalepsy and narcolepsy? Are those types of things starting to show up with these Trump shots?
I know about the narcolepsy. I don't know personally about the catalepsy, but I wouldn't be surprised. Mm-hmm. I mean, in general, when you look at the data bank or the what the government compensation board pays out over time for vaccine injuries, the biggest payer has been up until now been the flu vaccine, and it's all, it falls into two categories: neurologic categories and autoimmune type disease. And that's, so it shouldn't be surprising. That's what we're seeing here. It's consistent, but out of, you know, much, much worse. Mm-hmm. It's much, much worse.
And we've never seen in any of these other vaccines, we've never seen anything that really kind of attacks the circulatory system and the heart. This is pretty new for this Trump shot, isn't it?
Well, I guess we've seen it, but it's been rare. You know, mm-hmm. I went back and I looked at various diagnoses. Like one of them is cavernous sinus thrombosis. That's the one that young lady had that you mentioned, and the neurosurgeon took her to the operating room and opened it up, but couldn't save her. It's a very rare disease that for most people, we go through our whole medical career, we don't see it. And it involves the big vessels of the brain getting clotted. Well, if you go back, I went back on multiple diagnoses, and I went 2017, 2018, 2019, 2020, and then 2021. And if you do it for that disorder, it goes something like this. It goes 0001040. You know, and that was way a long time ago. Now it's over, I think, 160 cases of cavernous sinus thrombosis.
Wow.
When you look at least worldwide. So that's what you see almost everywhere. It's just nothing, 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 nothing huge.
Mm-hmm.
And so.
Yeah, there was a French epidemiologist, and she went through country by country in different all the different regions of the world, you know, going to the Middle East, going to Africa, going to Asia, Europe, Latin America. And she, country by country, she showed how, you know, you'd have a rise in COVID diagnosis, and then they would introduce something like ivermectin or whatever, drop to zero. And then they introduce the vaccines, and it just goes straight up like a spike. And right. This is happening everywhere. Why, you know, again, it's the media that is doing this. And, of course, we're seeing over the weekend big protest in the UK at the BBC offices, another protest in Italy at a couple of large newspapers, because people realize that they have become the handmaids of this propaganda. They're not fooled by this. I mean, the people lived under the Soviet Union. They were not fooled by Izvestia and Pravda. They knew they were being lied to. People now know we're being lied to. What do you think is the best thing that we can do to try to get this information out? I mean, is it putting together, as that football player did, a website where, you know, we can start collecting people's testimonies about what happened to their lives so that we can put a face on it? Because, you know, statistics, as Stalin said, it's just a number, but a personal story is a tragedy. The other side used this in a very lying way, you know, finding people who had leukemia and saying, you know, this, it's buried in the story that's leukemia, but they make it look like a young person died from COVID that was an athletic soccer player. And so they knew that it was personal stories. Perhaps, what do you think? Is that perhaps the best way that we can do this, to tell people personal stories?
Oh, I absolutely think personal stories are the way to go, in addition to data. But here's the problem I think we're up against, is the fact that that this is a war. We have to stop.
Yeah, that's
you know,
right.
I tell people, you know, if you think you're fighting a virus, you're going to act like a victim. If you think you're fighting a war, then you're going to act like a warrior. And the reason this is so important is there's so many people that still think the world is just like it was 2 months ago or 2 years ago. And it's we're like the people living in Sarajevo, that one day they had a world-class city, and the next day, if they weren't paying attention, stepped out of their house, they got struck with a bullet.
Yeah.
People are unaware, and the paradigm has changed, and we have to stop thinking of this as a disease, because this is a war against you, against your children. They don't really care. I think they almost don't even care if they take the pharmaceutical companies down with them. This is a killing program, and once you get that in your head, then you won't be fooled by all this. But the intelligence services own the media.
That's
I mean,
right.
and
That's
they
right.
own the fact checkers.
That's
you know,
right.
Fact-checking is not something a normal person does. They just put out the truth. But if you see the same thing coming out by false, that's an intelligence program. And that's what we're dealing with. So, I mean, thank goodness for you guys in the alternative media, and that's the only way it's getting out. But I think people are waking up to it. What we need to not let happen is the bullying and shaming of the unvaccinated, because that could take off, in my opinion. I mean, this, we're close to the yellow star.
Yes.
If you cannot let that happen. And
that's right.
And it's scary that you see people writing things like on Twitter or whatever that they claim to be worried about humanity, and yet they're willing to put unvaccinated people up against the, you know, the gully and shoot them.
That's
literally one of the tweets I saw. It's terrible.
And I think that's where we are right now. There's a big propaganda campaign to demonize the unvaccinated. And I just, before you came on, I talked about the Green Zone paper that came out by the CDC back in July, where they already talk about their determinant camps and for people who are a threat to society, how they're going to isolate them, how they're going to have camp guards and everything. So we're talking about concentration camps. They have to get everybody on board with putting people into concentration camps. Don't think that it can't happen here. I mean, we did that in World War II. People that were guilty by association of being Japanese descent, they didn't have anything on them in particular. So we are capable of doing that. Every society is capable of doing that. That's not an aberration coming from the Soviet Union or Nazi Germany. Everybody is capable for it. So we got a massive propaganda campaign preparing the people for it. A year ago, we've got the plan from the CDC about how they want to do this. I'm glad to see that Joe Rogan and Rand Paul are talking about how this is tyranny. We got to resist this and we got to do it now. It's about 514 days too late. And the real issue, as you pointed out, is people not catching up to this rapidly metastasizing war that is happening, not getting their head around what the current status is and how far we're into this and how little time is left.
And it's so important that we take to the streets or do whatever we need to do now while we still can.
Yes.
Because if we don't take it back now, what's going to happen is just like in the Soviet Union, when the Cheka would come and pick somebody up in the middle of the night, because they'll pick you off singly and, you know, come quietly, comrade, don't disturb the neighbors.
That's right.
That's what's going to happen. And you can't fight by yourself. You have to fight in a group. And now's the time. And God love the French. I'm pretty impressed with the French getting out there and manning the streets.
Yeah.
And, you know, I didn't quite expect that of them. But look at Australia. That is for 9 deaths. Australia is literally locking their whole world down. And I don't know if you saw that. And this is the other thing it does. It creates ugly capos. If you saw the security guard in, I think it was New Zealand or Australia someplace, that there was a woman without a mask on, and they had her by the neck, and she passed out. And then they grabbed her by the back of the shirt and the back and her seat of her pants and literally threw her onto the floor, you know, just like a rag doll.
That's right.
And she ended up dying.
Yeah.
She was ending up being murdered for not wearing a mask. It's the ugliest video you'll ever see. And I just thought, this is where, you know, it doesn't take much, apparently, to get some people to be capos.
Yes, that's
and
right.
And that's the problem.
And it's really rolled out more in Australia than any other place. Again, a place where they've had very few cases, virtually no deaths in a country of over 25 million people. You got 9 people who die of this. I mean, how many other things can you find that are that low a fatality rate? But it really is a program that is rolling out. And what people need to understand in America is this isn't anything that's Australian. This is the same agenda globally. They're just rolling it out at a different pace in different places based on what people will put up with and what they can get away with it. And that's what's really concerning, because now, Dr. Merritt, they're you know, within the next month, we're going to have the FDA rubber stamping this, violating all their rules. I mean, they can give emergency authorization to something, but they can't authorize something according to their own rules without running through a long-term test. Adding a lot of people does not make it a long-term test. And so they're going to violate their rules. They're going to rubber stamp this, and Fauci is out there bragging about how all the corporations are going to run this coercion through. And that was something from the very beginning. The New England Journal of Medicine was saying, we're going to do this through corporate coercion, not through legislation, because we don't want to have challenges to due process. They don't want to have any due process.
Right. And they've committed fraud on so many levels, speaking of the New England Journal. I mean, Think of the fraud about hydroxychloroquine.
Yes.
That they actually published false papers. And the data, it wasn't just that they massaged the data, it's that the data was made up by a storefront, non-existent data bank run by a porn star and a science fiction writer. It's almost funny if it weren't so bizarre, but it's dangerous. And the thought that they went to these lengths, I mean, this is something beyond the pale that we've never seen. I mean, we've never seen this kind of fraud at all levels, because this is unrestricted warfare. And you know, there's a famous book now by the Colonel Zhao and Wang, and from 1999, that talk exactly like that. If you want to read what's going on, you just read that book, because they talk about multidimensional warfare, and the bio warfare and the psych warfare here is just a part of it. This is a part of it.
Yes.
And we know
the society that they want. They've been talking about how they're going to, the UN 2030 agenda is when they wanted this in place. And we know that these people have been, we know what their details were. They were always trying to sell it with a climate disaster. They pulled out a different, put in a different justification for that, and then rolled out all their detailed plans. So we know that this is a moment in history where they have chosen to rewrite everything in society and to do it globally, to have a global ID with these vaccine passports. I mean, you've even got people in France as part of these protests this last week, Dr. Merritt, who are fully vaccinated, who are burning their vaccine card because they understand exactly where this is headed. Yeah,
I saw that. That's pretty, like I say, I'm pretty impressed with the French. And the only reason it's happening there and not here yet is because we're armed. It's that simple. You know, I mean, I was on an Australian medical, it's called the COVID Medical Network, and this is probably 6 months ago. And it was kind of funny because one of the doctors there asked me, well, what are you guys in America going to do if they mandate this vaccine? And I couldn't take it anymore, because it turned out, by the way, I couldn't even mention the word hydroxychloroquine on that program. they could lose their license. So I was trying to talk about the use of this drug, and it was like Voldemort, he who shall not be named. It got to be really absurd. But at the end of time, he asked me, what about you guys in the vaccines? And I finally couldn't take it. And I just said to him, I said, you know, in my area of the country, the state north of me, if you put those guys together, all of the hunters in that state together, they constitute the fifth largest standing army in the world. I don't think you're going to pull those guys out and vaccinate them forcibly easily. And the guy was just about had apoplexy. I mean, he could barely breathe.
But well, you know, that's what you see.
That's why we have the Second Amendment.
And that's why this last election cycle, we had so many Democrats who kept saying, well, we have a military and we can use that against the gun owners. I've never seen a politician go there before to threaten people with gun confiscation and threaten the use of the military. I believe that's another reason why they're putting through this mandatory vaccination, to push out soldiers that are not going to be on board with all of this stuff. I think that they're running through these corporate mandates largely because they want to reduce the workforce because they want to move towards automation and blame it on COVID. So I think there's alternative motives to all this stuff, but it is all being coordinated. It is all coming to a head. My big concern, Dr. Merritt, is the fact that, as you and I know, and as our listeners here know, this is a war. It's on a very short term. They're going to really escalate this to the next level as soon as the FDA rubber stamps this thing. But we've got people who are looking at medical professionals who don't want to take this, and other people in other professions. I mean, we've got enough people that we could have a parallel society, but we don't have any way to truly organize this and to come together, do we, at a local level? Or do you know of any way?
Well, I mean, you know, it turns out that even for the flu vaccine, when polled, 60 to 70% of physicians tried not to take it. Okay, the nurses got mandated, but they tried to get out of it. And the other thing that I've discovered, at least in my state, I know if you're a unionized nurse, you don't have to take the flu vaccine. Hmm. So there's already been some unions that are organized, and they are organized, that they are standing up for their union members not taking this vaccine. So there is some point there. But ultimately, you know, how many businesses can live with 30% of the workforce gone overnight?
Yeah.
It doesn't, you know, I know that hospitals are on bypass because they don't have any nurses. What's going on here? Mm-hmm. People are retiring. People are not just, it's not so obvious because it's not just the people saying, okay, let's stand together in the street and say no. No, a lot of the older nurses and people are just leaving the profession. They're getting out. They're retiring. Doctors are retiring. And what you're left with is a short work staff that now is going to get shorter.
Yeah.
And
that's one of the things you mentioned, doctors with a flu shot getting exceptions. That's one of the things that really makes me angry. You know, we talk about informed consent. I should be able to determine what I want to do with my medical care, get multiple opinions from different doctors and so forth. But when you talk about forcing doctors and nurses to take this Trump shot, I mean, you've got politicians dictating health care to doctors and nurses over their own, you know, personal autonomy, as well as over their own medical knowledge. It's absolutely astounding, isn't it?
It is. And quite frankly, if you are forced to take anything into your body because the government tells you to, then you are a slave to the government. It's
That's
that
right.
simple.
Oh, yeah.
There's
Absolutely.
No intermediate.
Oh, yeah. It is a form of enforced slavery. I believe that as they keep pushing on these extended unemployment benefits, these stimulus checks, their plan is that the people who are really hardcore pull off against this if they have any, they're going to try to keep us off of unemployment, pull that out there as a stick to force us to get the vaccine. They're going to put a social welfare net out there, but then there's going to have the conditions tied to that. It's really well thought out. And I think people are going to have to really come to the understanding that it's really up to you to start to prepare for yourself and how you're going to provide for your family, because we're going to have to come together as communities, but we got to start by preparing in the very short term for how we're going to get through this, because they're about to hit us with a hammer as soon as this FDA approval is done. Don't you feel within the next month?
I think so, but I do. Here's a ray of hope that I really like from Patrick King in Alberta that took down Alberta recently. And you know, his story is he was fined $1,200 because he was in a crowd of over 10 people. Well, what he did, and the great news is he's not a lawyer, and because of that, I think he's a gas and oil man, and he just figured out the heart of the beast here really easy. You know, and this is under the category that all politics is local. We've got these great big kind of amorphous lawsuits, and I love what Reiner Fulmisch is doing, but not all of us can participate in something like that. It's huge and it's complicated. But what Patrick King figured out is that the indictment against him was not amorphous. It was written by, Henshaw or something like that, the actual chief medical officer of the province. Okay, mm-hmm. So she personally was prosecuting him. It was her versus him. And so what he did is he demanded that someone demonstrate to him that they have evidence that SARS-CoV-2 has been isolated, and they couldn't do it. They couldn't come up with it. They say, we don't have that information. And they tried to say, well, then it doesn't matter. We're just going to skip that because we don't have that information. He said, no, that is the basis for the whole health rule and all these rules. If you don't have a there, there's no virus. You can't be enforcing all these rules because there's a virus. And so, but he did it at her personally. And I think what she probably, and she rolled. And so she said, yep, we don't have that. And now there's no mask mandate. They opened up Alberta. Ah. So there's a way forward because it's an,
well, it'll be interesting to see what happens in Alberta, because that's where they really come the hardest after a lot of these pastors, you know, in that conservative province.
Right.
And so it'll be interesting to see what happens with that. But I think it's also interesting that it came after her personally, because she's a dictator, isn't she? I mean, you know, this is just the law's in my mouth type of thing.
See, and I think the beauty of that is, the big guys that we don't, the unnamed co-conspirators in the shadows, the big guys with all the money that funded, you know, Gates to fund Fauci, to fund all these universities and everything that brought this thing to us, we may not know their names, and they don't let them be known, but they make sure that these lesser minions are personally responsible. So if somebody goes down, it's not going to be them, it's going to be her. It's going to be people like her and your governor, for example, and, you know, different people. So what we need to do is make them personally accountable for the fraud.
Yes. Yes.
That has a local implication.
Yes, that's very important. Well, that's good news. And on that good news, we will say thank you for joining us. And I'll tell people your website is drleemerritt.com, and that is DrLeeMerritt. DrLeeMerritt.com. Thank you. It's been a real pleasure talking to you. Thank you for standing for the truth. I know that that is not something that is easy to do for anyone. And I know how they come after medical professionals who tell people the truth now. It's absolutely astounding. But thank you for standing for the truth in spite of all of the pressure and the shaming and all the rest of the stuff that they throw out after you. Thank you so much, Dr.
Thank
Merritt.
Thank you so much.
Governor Asa Hutchinson, as people are very upset about him, he was the governor who said, well, I'm very sorry that we took off those mask mandates and these other things, and I really would like to have them back, but I can't do it now. I signed it. I really regret that. Maybe the courts will do it, and of course the courts did do it for him. And here's what his constituents said.
People get sick from...
You're lying. We know the truth.
Let's identify.
We know the truth. You're lying.
Would you all like to be...
We know the truth, Governor.
Or would you just like to yell? We're going to be living with people dying if we do not increase our vaccination rates. So I still need to get that message out. And so it sounds like some people want low vaccination rates. Okay.
Yeah, he's so out of touch with him. Isn't that amazing?
No, don't give her the mic.
Out by the WHO in October, November.
So explain to me why...
Don't give her the mic.
There are so many that have the vaccine that are getting the virus. I can name... What's in the vaccine? Give me the insert sheet.
The insert sheet's blank.
So if informed consent means you tell me what you put in my body. If Mr. Doctor gives me a vial and says, trust me, I'll give you a vial. You trust me.
Every SARS-2 COVID vaccine that's available on the market is manufactured using aborted fetal tissue. I have been praying that God himself will step in so that Christians are not forced by their employers and a mandate to get the vaccine. Yet, even if God does not, I will not bow. And with all respect, Governor, we love you and appreciate you, but God will not hold you guiltless if you fail to stand up to the Christians who believe it is in their right to abstain from the vaccine.
The numbers, again, are being manipulated to try to force unvaccinated people towards a mandated vaccine. And I know you may not see that now, but it's down the road. Everything that was a conspiracy 6 months ago is now coming to fruition. And 6 months ago, the story's going to be different.
Thank you.
My whole family had COVID. But let me tell you something. All of us took the therapeutics from day one. And if doctors were allowed to tell the truth and treat their patients with these therapeutics, we would not have hospitals full of sick people dying.
It's medically incentivized malpractice.
Don't smirk at me, Governor. You should care.
Don't smirk at me. He's smirking.
On what works? What will save lives?
Isn't that amazing? Well, those people are wide awake in Arkansas. And what is truly amazing is the arrogance of this shill for the establishment. Again, Asa Hutchinson going on this last weekend and all the talking head shows. Oh, yeah, you know, I signed that bill. I'm really sorry. And we need to get the judicial system to throw that out, and they did for him. And then he's smirking at these people. I'm sure that he will not have another one of these meetings because these people came loaded with facts. And we'll talk about the Christian approach to this mandate again because we've had some more come out about that. But when we look at bad governors, what about... Greg Abbott. Greg Abbott is now out there asking hospitals to delay elective procedures. Hey, Greg Abbott, you're not a doctor. Stop playing one on TV. Stop virtue signaling to the national press and your globalist controllers. This is a guy who, on day one of getting his power and his money, what did he do? He shoveled off $300 million for contact tracing to a company that both Republicans and Democrats said, who are these people? This guy's got a bogus resume. They got an empty office here. And we've seen what happened with these elective procedures being shut down. You know, elective procedures like cancer. Oh, that's elective. We're not going to do that. Stop practicing medicine. Stop financially incentivizing medical malpractice, as that one lady said. She said, yeah, everybody in my family's had it, and we used cheap and available therapeutics. And if doctors were allowed to do this, you wouldn't have the emergency rooms packed with this. It is financially incentivized malpractice. They're paying them to put leeches on people and mercury in their veins. If you want to go back to George Washington's case, that's what this amounts to. And so, let's start doing just voluntarily. He's going to tell the doctors what to do. I'm so sick and tired of politicians telling doctors what they have to do. The doctors, even telling the doctors, you're going to have to take the vaccine, when the doctors don't want it personally. They're going to take away their licenses if they actually treat people therapeutically. And if they decide that they want to opt out of an experimental vaccine because they thoroughly understand it.
In recent weeks, the speculators have been waging an all-out war on the American dollar. The strength of a nation's currency is based on the strength of that nation's economy. And the American economy is by far the strongest in the world. Accordingly, I have directed the Secretary of the Treasury to take the action necessary to defend the dollar against the speculators. I have directed Secretary Connally to suspend temporarily the convertibility of the dollar into gold or other reserve assets, except in amounts and conditions determined to be in the interest of monetary stability and in the best interest of the United States. Now, what does this action, which is very technical, what does it mean for you? Let me lay to rest the bugaboo of what is called devaluation. If you want to buy a foreign car or take a trip abroad, market conditions may cause your dollar to buy slightly less. But if you are among the overwhelming majority of Americans who buy American-made products in America, your dollar will be worth just as much tomorrow as it is today. The effect of this action, in other words, will be to stabilize the dollar.
All right, and joining us now is Tony Arterburn, and you can find him at wisewolf.gold. And we're going to talk about, this is 50 years ago today, guys, on a Friday the 13th, August the 13th, 1971. That's what Nixon said at the time. Thank you for joining us, Tony.
It's great to be back, David. You know, I hosted for you. The last time I hosted was Friday the 13th in November of 2020. And then the previous Friday the 13th to that was Trump's executive order. So
yeah.
We're circling around that day, but I'm really happy to be here.
There is something to Friday the 13th being unlucky, except that I'm happy to have you on and happy to have you guest host for that. Now, you heard what Nixon was saying there. He was telling everybody, you know, we have these outside speculators, and they're doing all kinds of nasty things to us, and it isn't going to really affect us to go off the gold standard. Because, and really at that time, we had 3/4 of the world's gold here in the U.S., and our economy, only 10% of it was imports. Things have really changed. Now we're all imports, we're no gold, and we can look at what's happened to the value of the dollar after all this. I don't think it worked too well, did it?
No, and the timeline after that has been disastrous. It accelerated everything. And I would go back to Nixon's statements. He said that he was going to suspend the gold window temporarily.
Oh, yeah.
So he's playing 4D chess. Let's just put it that way. At 50 years, temporarily, we'll see. It might come back. They may reopen the gold window.
Well, that's the problem. All these temporary restrictions that they put on our freedom, these temporary setting aside the Constitution that these people do, they are never temporary, are they? And that's why I said from the very beginning, I said, if we let these people take us, it is going to be hell to get it back.
Well, right. Of course, the Secretary of the Treasury at the time was John Connally, who was riding in the car with Kennedy the day he was murdered.
Yeah.
And that's what they based the magic bullet theory off of Connally. And of course, this is the magic money tree. this is the theory of the magic money tree and the endless printing. Of course, 1972, David, we opened China. 1973, you get the Trilateral Commission. It's also the last year that we ran a trade surplus in this country. Wages have been in decline and stagnant since then. But the wheels have really come off with the monetary policy, as you and I have done, you know, interviews in the last 2 or 3 years. I mean, really accelerated to the unbelievable proportions under the Trump administration.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I began the show by saying that Trump was saying this $3.5 trillion that Biden is putting in. That's a path to communism. And it's like, oh, your $3.7 trillion that you put in last year is a path to communism. I mean, they're on the same path. Right. They're driving us, you know, left and right are pushing us into communism. And there's not even a difference anymore at the speed at which they drive. It used to always be the same thing. You know, we'd say, well, they're going in the same direction, but the Democrats are going at a faster speed than the Republicans. That's not true anymore. Not true.
Right. It's not true at all. It's just it's a marketing ploy. You know, it's propaganda to believe that the Republican Party is here to help you stave off Marxism. They're just pushing it along and giving it a different brand.
That's
you
right.
You see that before the
they're normalizing it. They're normalizing it. It's kind of a ratcheting effect.
Right. And you see this before the lockdowns, before the scamdemic, before that. The central bank, the Federal Reserve, had pumped about $6 trillion into the repo markets. And you and I discussed that. We were talking about it like the GDP of nations like, you know, South Korea in one day.
Yeah.
You know, or one month. And so it would just be the acceleration rate under, you know, 2020 under Trump is really what's pushed us into where even mainstream financial networks that are usually cheerleaders for the stock market are saying, oh, we're really worried about inflation. Like really worried, you know, I've been worried about that for a long time and you're seeing it. You're
yeah,
seeing
it's taken
it
off.
Happen.
It's taken off. We're making the it's jump to off. Warp speed right now.
Right.
It's like better fasten your seatbelts because it's coming in really, really hard. Before we get into what's coming up and we know what their agenda is and let's talk about that. You know, it's really about the, it's about having a cashless society, having central bank digital currencies, I believe. But before we get into that, the things that actually that Nixon did with that action, he closed the gold window, as you just heard. And then, of course, he let the dollar float. You know, he's the father of fiat currency, placing a temporary freeze on wages and prices in order to, quote unquote, combat inflation. I wonder if we're going to see that from Biden. And then, of course, he put a 10% tariff on imports to improve the balance of payments. But as you pointed out, subsequently, you know, Nixon, along with Kissinger, who's a real power behind the throne, he was the one who opened up everything to China. But when you look at the presidency of Nixon, I mean, the wage and price controls, taking us off the gold standard, centralizing control of speed limits even, to 55 miles an hour that we had on the interstate system, and then implementing the UN's drug war, because that was a UN program that came up in 1961. He put it in. That's another thing he did in 1971. He just copied it over, put his right. put the U.S. at the top and signed his name at the bottom and called it his drug war. But it had the four schedules. It had all the drugs that went into each of those schedules. Marijuana, they put that in as schedule number one, which said it had no medical use. That was a lie. And then he created the EPA. He created the Department of Energy. I mean, what a disaster. How in the world does somebody wind up with a tattoo of Nixon on their back? I don't know.
I've got a portrait of Nixon here in the office. My grandfather gave me a book by Richard Nixon before he died called In the Arena. And I thought it was a really interesting book. And I've been not a fan, but I've been someone who has looked into the legacy of Nixon because he's the only president that was made to resign.
Yeah.
So somebody didn't want him there. I've always thought that was interesting history, of course, replaced by Gerald Ford, who was on the Warren Commission, and, of course, the vice president, Rockefeller. So looking at that, I think that's interesting history.
Yeah.
If you go back and you see the decision in 71, David, was based off of the fact that we didn't have the gold, really, to distribute to these countries. We had been running deficits. You know, first you start seeing, just like any empire, they take the silver out of the coinage. This happened in 1965, starting the devaluation of our coin money, our half dollars, quarters, and dimes. And then looking back at 1933, you have Franklin Roosevelt telling everyone to turn in their gold. So the, you know, the old gold pieces, $20, $5, $10 gold pieces, those were mandatory to turn in. So Americans couldn't even own gold. So technically, the American people weren't really on the gold standard throughout the 30s into 1971. It just became official between countries because the United States had, you know, we had the Vietnam War. You had LBJ's Great Society we had to pay for.
Yeah, and so they called that
devaluating the currency.
That's right. They called that the guns and butter approach, because you had the welfare state, the Great Society, the war on poverty, all that sort of thing from Lyndon Johnson. And then what Nixon did was he continued that, and then he added the war on, Vietnam, escalated that. Of course, Johnson had the war on Vietnam as well. But it's, massive welfare state, massive warfare state, warfare and welfare, and that's exactly where we are right now, except now it's on steroids. I mean, look at how many different countries we're at war with. We're having a Vietnam moment again right now with what's going on in Afghanistan. I talked about this a couple of months ago. I said we're moving up to a Saigon moment where everybody's going to have to be helicoptered out, and that's what they're doing. They're helicoptering in thousands of troops right now to helicopter out the Americans at the embassy in Kabul and UK civilians and other government personnel. It's going to be a fire drill to get everybody out of there, just like we saw with Vietnam. We never learn our lessons. Instead, we not only repeat the lessons, but we double and triple down, or even more so, on all of these problems in terms of the welfare state and the warfare state.
Right, and everything accelerates. Once you completely untether from the gold standard, which this country was founded on a gold and silver bimetal standard, only Congress could coin money, and it had to be gold and silver. The founders were very wise and knew that if you didn't have accountability at a certain level, if you had no accountability at all, if you had fiat currency, you're going to have the reality that we have today, which is a complete tyranny. It's a financial tyranny state propped up by the bankster class and this international order. And look, that's why I wanted to talk about the central banks printing so much money. That was unheard of in the 1970s. Yeah. And look at the demographic changes in our leadership. The financial sector that was unheard of in the 1970s. I mean, all these financial products and all these things that came out afterwards, these were geared to put the American people into perpetual stock market casino gamble. And that's where you see that industry took off, and it bought the congressmen. It bought the politicians. This was in 1970. Congress had about 70-75% of the Congress was made up of U.S. Military veterans. Today, it's about like 17%, because most of these people are handpicked from the elite class. It takes about $2 million to run for Congress. You ran for Congress. I ran for Congress. We know how much money poured into these congressional districts.
Yeah, I didn't spend anywhere close to $2 million.
Well, I didn't either, and that's why I didn't win.
Well, we didn't win. That's right. Right. Yeah. I didn't spend close to $2,000. I printed up some signs and went around with my family, sticking them in yards and public places, not in yards, but in public places. As right. Karen drove, I would hop out, and the kids were in car seats. But anyway, yeah, I know how that works.
That's the reality that's created by fiat currency is a degraded civilization, and I think we're reaching an end game of the U.S. dollar. It's not going to be tomorrow, but you can't keep propping this up by just printing more of them. There's no fiscal sanity anymore. Everything's off the cliff. I mean, they talk about things in the stimulus bill, or not stimulus, the infrastructure bill. We're going to tax crypto, $28 billion, which is a drop in the bucket. Yeah. That's a punishment tax, has nothing to do with revenue.
That's right.
So, no, everything tracks back to it, Dave. That's why this date's important. Nixon is actually Sunday the 15th. Nixon interrupted a broadcast of Bonanza. Now,
he should be impeached for that. I mean, there's absolutely no excuse for that. That's probably what happened to him, Tony.
Well, that was right. It was the Bonanza fiasco. No, yeah. Well, he interrupted the broadcast of Bonanza. And, of course, that show is based off of a big rush to go find gold and silver in Nevada.
That's right.
I thought that was ironic, So.
Yeah, I think we know who was behind the grassy knoll now. It was it was Adam Cartwright. grabbed Nixon, tie him up to a horse and run him through the through the cactus field or something. Anyway. Go ahead.
Right. We definitely can see the effects of fiat currency and the damage that it's done. But the good news that came out of this, after 1971, of course, Nixon driven from office in 1974, Ford takes over. And look, Gerald Ford, Warren Commission member, whatever you want to say about him, he overturned Franklin Roosevelt's executive order, making it illegal for Americans to own gold. So I can't believe the Supreme Court didn't stop him. I mean, I thought that the presidents couldn't overturn previous presidents' executive orders.
That's right, yeah.
So we found that out under Trump. But no, he overturned it and made gold illegal or to own. And most people don't even realize that. You couldn't even own, couldn't have a Krugerrand, couldn't have a Gold Eagle. So this is where we can have our own gold and silver standard.
Yeah.
I mean, the dollar is never going to be tied to gold again, regardless of what QAnon devotees will tell you. I had people come in my shop telling me I have a good authority that we're going to, you know, Trump took over the treasury and he's still running it from Mar-a-Lago and there's going to be a gold standard. And I just, can have your own.
We heard last year that, you know, Trump is in danger of assassination. Alex was red alert. Because he's taken over the Federal Reserve with the Department of Justice, and it's like, no.
No, that's not happening. The Treasury and the Fed are the same thing now.
That's right.
I mean, there used to be some arm's length separation, but now you have Janet Yellen. I mean, it's all one entity.
That's right.
And really, they're just stewards of getting this thing to the bottom. I mean, they're just trying to get it to a soft landing, and then I think the replacement will be the central bank digital currency, David.
That's right. That's right. And so going back, you know, before we had, and a lot of people call that, I guess, Bretton Woods 2 or whatever, where he did the shock. I don't know if that's, but the real Bretton Woods that happened right after World War II, they had a conference with 40-some-odd nations, and what they agreed they would do was fix the price of gold. Since the U.S. owned 3/4 of the world's gold, they fixed the price of gold at $35 an ounce.
Right.
And but the problem was that you had the Federal Reserve and you had these welfare programs that were creating more and more spending, and they had basically disconnected, even though everybody else was fixing the value of the dollar by gold, they had broken that connection with their spending. And so all these other countries are saying, wait a minute, you violated this agreement. And so in a sense, it was done in a sense from external pressure, because people realized that the dollar was already a fiat currency. It already was fraudulent. And so the markets were starting to put that in. That's what Nixon was complaining about. He said, hey, these people are trading on this stuff and pushing it around, and look, we're having these movements. Well, it was because the market was reacting to what was already a lie and had been a long-term lie in the U.S. And so that's why he did that. And so then what they did at this point was they created the petrodollar, and they essentially worked with the Saudis, put them in the catbird seat, if you will, with a lot of what is happening with our economy, saying that if you buy up our fiat currency, we'll sell you weapons and all sorts of other things. And so that created the petrodollar. Now what we're looking at, as you just pointed out, we're looking at going to a central bank digital currency. And this is something that's being talked about by China, being talked about by the European Central Bank, by the Federal Reserve, all of them. That's what they're pushing for. So talk to us about the implications that will have for us.
Well, sure. I'll speak to that, but I will tell you, watch what they do and not so much what they say.
Right now,
all the central banks around the world are buying gold at the record pace. As a matter of fact, the record after Bretton Woods in 1944, the highest amount of gold ordered by countries and central banks was in 2018 at like 650 tons. We're already surpassing that this year. It's already at 333 tons, and that it was as of June. Mm-hmm. So we're going to break the all-time record. Central banks around the world are buying gold. They're going to talk about the central bank digital currencies, because that way they can expand and contract the money supply in real time. They can also censor you. They can put expiration dates on the currency.
That's right. Because
if you look at right now, the petrodollar, the U.S. dollar, 65% of all the paper currency ever printed is outside of the continental United States. 80% of all the $100 bills are outside of the United States. They would do, I think, just about anything to get control of that money supply, who's spending it and how. It gives them a lot more leverage. That's why I think it's really a race to the bottom with what they're doing and printing the dollar, and the Fed as it stands will change, and that will become the digital wallet, digital system. However, David, the central banks and the governments are buying gold.
Mm-hmm.
They don't believe in fiat currency. They know that it's a scam. They know what it's doing is devalue. Every day that they get up and print more or hit the key to make more units, they devalue it. They know that.
Yeah, that's right.
They don't want the public to know. That's just why the clown show of last week, gold had a flash crash based off of the jobs numbers. And the jobs numbers were, hey, we have excess jobs. Well, yeah, you have excess. People aren't working because they're getting the UBI.
That's right.
And but they sold it, and the financial network sold it like, look, happy times are here again. We're going to go get, you know, get back into the stock market, which is such a scam. And so I'm looking at, I was hosting your show on August 6th when gold hit its all-time high last year. Mm-hmm. And I think it got close to like 2050. Right mm-hmm. now it's trading under $1,800 an ounce. There's a push by central banks to keep the price low because they're buying it. Same mm-hmm. thing with silver. They're buying it. We can have our own gold and silver standard. I think that the digital currencies are inevitable. I mean, they're gonna push them. They're gonna make them. They're already targeting the actual real digital currencies like Bitcoin through these. You know, just it's just the beginning of the censorship and the war on things like cryptocurrency, things like Bitcoin through the infrastructure bill. That's just beginning. But you see, the central banks are buying the gold, and then they're pushing the digital currency. Because, you know, remember the golden rule, David. He who has the gold makes the rules.
That's right. And because, you know, when we look at a fiat monetary system, it's based on trust. It's based on confidence because it's a con game. And so what you're seeing here is that all these banks and other investors and people who are in the know, they understand they don't have any confidence in this. That's why you're seeing these types of actions being made. You know, I saw, Tony, when I looked at what people said 10 years ago when it was the 40th anniversary of the Nixon shock. This is what Forbes said. They said, today the dollar is worth less than two dimes in purchasing power compared to the pre-Nixon dollar. Well, that would be 20 cents on the dollar. Here we are 10 years later, and it's worth 1.9 cents based on the current price today, which was, just like you said, just under $1,800 an ounce. So it's I guess we could say that's my 2 cents worth. that's what this thing is worth. It's worth 2 cents. Your dollar's worth 2 cents, even compared to Nixon's time 50 years ago when it was worth 20 cents on the dollar, where it had originally been before they started messing with it with the Federal Reserve. And so when we look at the moves going towards crypto, again, you know, you had the efforts to try to push back. It was put in the infrastructure bill to put a tax on crypto. As you pointed out, it's just a punishment tax. It doesn't have anything to do with fiscal responsibility. When you're looking at a bill that is $3.5 trillion and you're talking about a $28-30 billion tax, they presume they're going to get on that. So it has absolutely nothing to do with that. It's a punishment tax. And we've been seeing governments, especially China, reported last week how the one of the largest, maybe the largest of the Bitcoin miners in China, this is about, he accounted with his one operation there in China, it was massive. He accounted for about 10% of the Bitcoins that were being mined before they shut him down. And they just came in and just like that, shut the whole thing down. And they're not going to be able to hide because they can find you based on your power profile. So we're starting to see actions like that taken. I know you also, besides gold and silver, you also sell Bitcoin at wisewolf.gold. What is your take on that? How is that? Because we've got the back and forth, you know, when we know that they're going to try to shut this down. We know they're going to try to establish their central bank digital cash. What is the, what is your feel on how we're going to be able to weather that for other cryptos?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say thank you for your service to all of your listeners, because whether you know it or not, you're now veterans. You've all been scripted into a war, because there's a war on all humanity, all of us.
That's
right. This is the monetary system war and the complete takeover of humanity through the technocracy.
That's right.
The war on Bitcoin, and regardless of what we can find out about its origin, I know something by its enemies. And the central banks, the World Bank, the IMF, they hate Bitcoin. They're punishing El Salvador for adopting it as legal tender. Places like China, they got its use out of it. You know, they said that we're open for business, all the rest. And I think they're priming their citizens for a digital currency. They used Bitcoin for a while and then got rid of it. This war is ongoing, and you're going to see places like El Salvador, South America pop up, where there's going to be more mining, more acceptance, and I think that's great. That's why I love national sovereignty and borders. I think it's important. You got to have a place to flee to. This is something that we're in the opening round. I don't think that that Bitcoin's going away in the near term, but we have to be careful. I mean, I think that in order for them to have complete supremacy of the digital realm, they're going to have to kill Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Completely.
Yeah.
And they're going to have to regulate it into oblivion. Just like I was talking to my co-host on my podcast for the Wise Wolf Golden Crypto Show. We were uncertain whether or not a transaction between peers is taxable, because mm-hmm. used to it just only if you go through an exchange, but they're making it so convoluted. And this is all, the thousand cuts to make it, to try to kill it.
And it begins with registration, just like it does with guns or anything else. First, they say, well, we'd just like to know a little bit about you for our files, Mrs. Robinson. And we'd like to know, where this is coming and where it's going. And then they come after you with a hammer.
Right. And that's why it's so important for all your listeners and the people that I talk to. Do your research. Look into the monetary system. Look into the fiat currency scam. Don't hang your future on it. Because mm-hmm. it's something that's so manipulated. The hidden tax of inflation is real. It's biting us all right now. You can go to the grocery store and see it. You buy lumber, or buy a used car. It's all there. It's built in. So, have your own gold and silver standard and get to know things like Bitcoin. I don't think it's going away, but I do think we've got a bumpy road ahead.
And I think, I think a wise wolf would say that you want to hedge your bets and you want to diversify into various things. And so that means, gold and Bitcoin are somewhat complementary to each other. We don't know exactly what the future holds. And so it's a good idea to hold a little bit of each. You're talking about inflation, Tony. Wholesale prices, even as they measure them, and of course we know that they exclude certain very important things deliberately to make it look better. That's why I said from the very beginning of this, you want to talk to me about the numbers? Well, I know how these guys have manipulated unemployment statistics. I know how they've manipulated inflation statistics and so forth. And so even with their manipulated numbers, we're seeing wholesale prices jumping 7.8%, the biggest surge on record, as steel jumps 23%. And to compare this back to, again, 1971, when Nixon did this, inflation for that year was 4.4%. So this is just the tip of the iceberg. They were calculating the inflation a lot more honestly back then. I think this has excluded a lot of things. Used cars were part of it because they had not foreseen a massive surge in used cars. And so that helped to bring a little bit of honesty to the numbers. They'll probably move to take those things out as well. But again, when we look at this, and that's a key part of it, gold as well as Bitcoin and silver, those are things that many of us would look at as a hedge against inflation. The investors are piling into the stock market as a hedge against inflation. But to me, that's just too much of a casino, the way I look at it.
Well, in 1971, companies and corporations were based off earnings, in the Ayn Rand sense of it's all profit-driven. Mm-hmm. Well, as you've spoken about many times, these big corporations just figured out it's easier just to get with the government. They don't have to serve customers anymore as long as they're the favored one.
That's right.
So that's the economy we have now. That in 1981, R. Buckminster Fuller wrote a book called Grunch of Giants, which stands for Gross Universal Cash Heist. And if you look at the 1970s, inflation started to really creep after we were untethered from gold. Inflation started to explode. So you had the chairman of the Fed, Paul Volcker, at the time, under the Carter administration, raised interest rates into the teens. Trying to buy a house in 1980, it's like a 13-14% interest rate or higher.
That's exactly what I paid. I had a third. We got out and we bought a house because both of us are working, and fixed interest rate of 13% kept you from buying very much of a house. That was 1980.
Right. So that was the 1970s. But David, they'll never do that again. They'll never have. I mean, they had to have. There was pain involved in that. They had to be responsible and get inflation under control. They'll never do that again. They can't. The entire economy is based off of the fake fiat. They got to keep pumping the monopoly money through it in order for it to even stay somewhat alive. I mean, I look out the window of my shop. I see cars on the road. I'm like, a lot of this is only due to the fact that the central banks are pumping money into this economy. Yeah. I mean, because they killed small business under the lockdowns.
That's right.
The supply chain has been severely strained. Inflation has hit us. Any sane economy would already start dealing with, the fallout from this. But we just keep printing money. So that I'm preparing I tell people, I don't give investment advice, because when you talk about is buying gold or silver going to make me money? I say gold and silver are money. And what you have is not money.
That's right.
So I don't know if you're going to be rich or I don't give investment advice. I just say, look, I think if you're working, have something to show for your work. If you're holding on to fiat currency, you're already losing. You know, Robert Kiyosaki, author of Rich Dad, Poor Dad, said it best. If you're a saver, you're a loser.
That's right. Because you look at the other thing that happened in the wake of all that massive inflation, because the interest rates got so high, they got rid of the usury laws. It used to be illegal to charge more than 10%. This is another, before we had the massive freedom issues that presented themselves in the last year, I kept saying, you know, hey, if there's somebody out there that wants to transcend the Republican, Democrat demographics, talk about the usury laws in terms of the bankers. Because now you've got a situation where they pay you less than 1%, but they can charge you 25, 30% or whatever it goes up to with the credit cards. It's absolutely outrageous what is happening, especially when you look at the spread. Prior to removing the usury laws, you wouldn't have a spread but just a few points between what they would pay savers and what they would charge borrowers. But now you look at the spread, and these people are running nothing other than a loan shark business. It's absolutely criminal.
Well, there's a reason that Andrew Jackson called them a den of vipers and thieves.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, and he said, I'm going to rout you out. And he killed the Second Bank of the United States. He wanted that on his tombstone, David. He said, I killed the bank on his tombstone because that's how much he hated the bankers. Mm-hmm. You know,
they nearly killed him, too.
Correct. That's exactly right. And you fast forward to 1913. And, you know, we get the Federal Reserve and look, it just slowly working its tentacles, devaluing the dollar, pushing us into foreign wars, bloating the welfare state, all of the things that we talk about.
That's right.
The New World Order, the deep state, you know, you can't have Donald Rumsfeld go in front of the press and say, hey, we can't track $2.3 trillion on September 10th, 2001. And we're going to look for it. And it's right over there in these accounting offices, on, you know, the next day. Something hit the Pentagon, right?
Yeah, so, yeah. Didn't see any plane parts there until after people had already taken pictures showing those plane parts. But, yeah, right. Went right into that window right there.
But you can't have that world if you're tethered, if you're tied to a metallic standard, because you have to account for it eventually. You can't lose money like you're a rock star and you left a briefcase full of cash somewhere. You can't do that. And that's what our government's done. And now we're at a point where, you know, the 1970s, you could raise interest rates. They're not going to do that, David.
The reason we had gold and silver put into the Constitution was because the people that wrote the Constitution had gone to the expensive school of experience, and they knew what it was like to have a fiat currency. The expression, not worth a continental, was talking about the fiat dollar that they had at the time that was worthless. And so they tried to bind them down with something that was objective like that. And that's, you know, the basic idea behind these cryptocurrencies as well. But as you point out, it really is, all this change is really being driven by the banks. Catherine Austin Fitz has pointed that out many, many times. It is, if you get right down to the root of it all goes back to the bankers. And we saw this, as you pointed out earlier, Tony, we saw this in the run-up to all this stuff back in the fall of 2019, the massive amounts of money that were being poured into this market that most of us had never even heard of, knew exist, called the repo market. They had already been pouring money in since the housing crisis in 2008-2009. And so they're creating this mountain, this gigantic bubble economy. And we all know that they're just going to pivot over to the cryptocurrency, the central bank cryptocurrencies, because it does a lot of different things. It wipes out this stuff, just like Nixon's moves 50 years ago. It gives them the opportunity to very quickly go to kind of a global economy. It gives them a universal ID and a way to track every single transaction, a way to control even more so everything that we do. As you pointed out, you know, time limitation on the Chinese are talking about that on their digital yuan, that they would give you money and you'd have to spend it within a certain amount of time. So just basically wipe out any ability to save anything. But the Europeans are talking about how they could control where you could spend the money. So you had to only shop at essential businesses that are partnered with them, and also control what you can buy with it. And we know also that it's going to be who is going to be able to buy stuff, because we've seen how PayPal is rolling this stuff out. rolling out the censorship. We just had Nick Fuentes had essentially a civil asset forfeiture done on his bank account by the FBI, ostensibly because of January 6th, even though he didn't get into the building or anything. So when we look at this, it is a worldwide tyranny, as you pointed out, a war, and it's going to be coming at us from the financial angle. And that's why I think it's very important for people to take a look at other ways to store their wealth, such as gold and cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin.
Well, that's right. And there's a reason why our Lord and Savior, for the one time he showed wrath and took out his whip, he went after the money changers.
Yeah.
You know, in the temple and threw the money changers out of the temple. There's a reason why.
That's right.
It's the root of all the evil. It's the love of money, the lust for it.
That's right.
So as we see the society being rolled out, the control mechanisms, the technocracy, all the things that are being implemented, it all tracks back to that. And as we set up our parallel society, as you talk about, I think it's important for people to educate themselves on how to use gold and silver, how to use cryptocurrencies, things that are not tied to the central bank, things that are not tied to the international order of things.
That's right. We're going to need to have a parallel. We're going to have an underground society. And we saw during the Depression, and there's still some museums around that have the printing presses where we had some communities were doing their own currency. They were, in some cases, they were making like wooden coins and things like that in order to facilitate exchange. But, you know, there's no substitute for the real stuff.
Well, I think also if we could get Travis to, in real time, whenever you say PayPal, bleep it out.
Yeah,
that would be because these are another example. You know, that's a great example of how you can be censored by a bank.
Yeah,
you know, for your speech, for your belief, whether you're a Christian, conservative, whatever, if you're anti-war, or anti-state, you're going to be censored by these mega corporations tied to the finance industry, and you should do everything you can to create your own standard.
That's right.
And physical metals are a great way to start. You know, and also you know, cryptocurrencies that I think are. I'll give you this: Bitcoin, Monero, Pirate Chain. These are things to look into and educate yourself on. I'll say that as much about cryptocurrency.
That's good. You mentioned Monero and Pirate Chain because those are two cryptocurrencies that do not create a blockchain of custody and right. Follow people. So that's good. Do you facilitate selling those as well, or are you just on Bitcoin and gold and silver?
So I have some Bitcoin ATMs, David, you can come to the shop, you can buy Bitcoin. If you come to the shop and you want to know about how to own Monero and Pirate Chain, I can help you do that. I mean, I won't charge you a fee. If somebody wants to call me and ask me how to do that, I can put them on some websites. I currently don't offer them, but I can help people get them. I will say I will accept them. Mm-hmm. You know, for payment, if you want to buy metals from me, we can work that out as well.
That's great. And you're in Branson, Missouri, is where your shop is. And
right.
People can find you on the internet at wisewolf.gold. And
wisewolf.
Of course, it's not just gold, but it's also silver. And as we've discussed in the past when I've talked to you, silver, because of the lower value, if you're going to talk about an underground economy, a parallel economy, that is something that's going to facilitate your being able to make exchanges with people, because typically you're not going to be buying $2,000 worth of something at a at a clip or whatever, you know, whatever the purchasing, regular purchasing price is. Thank you so much for joining us, Tony. Fascinating discussion of the 50th anniversary of a major reset of our economy and what is going to be coming up in the future. Thank you so much, Tony.
Thank you, David. Donate to this man. He's an American treasure.
Thank you. And thank you for your support. Tony is a supporter of the program as well. So support wisewolf.com. So let's talk about this mandate surge. Let's talk about what's going to happen to you and to your family and all of this. And I just want to remind you, as we look at tough times coming ahead for many of us, especially many people in my audience, I just want to say to you that you may or may not recognize that you live by the grace of God. You may think that you're in control. I thought it was really funny. I don't know the song, but I know the title. Jesus Take the Wheel. And when I heard that, it's kind of like, you know, there's another old song, you know, God is my co-pilot or whatever. It's like, no, he isn't your co-pilot. He's flying the plane that he built, that he maintains. But you say, Jesus, take the wheel. What I think of is, you know, you have these shopping carts for moms who have young kids, toddlers or whatever. And they can be very effective up to a certain age because they've got a steering wheel that you can just turn around and around and around. It's not connected to anything. It's just a bolt holding the thing on. You freely turn it. It's not turning any wheels, right? You know that. You've seen those things. You put the toddler in there, and it keeps them busy because they're driving that thing. And I can just imagine, and this is kind of what I always think of when I hear this title, Jesus Take the Wheel. I think it's Carrie Underwood who had that, if I recall. Yeah, there you go. There's one of them. But so where's the wheel? I guess you put the kid inside of that thing. Yeah, it's up there. Okay. So I can imagine, you know, this kid is driving, quote-unquote, driving the shopping cart throughout the grocery store. And it's been a long shopping trip, and this kid is just frustrated and, you know, just can't, is just tired, and just turns to mommy and says, mommy, you're going to have to take the wheel now. I can't do this driving anymore. And mom smiles just like Jesus. You were never driving. I got to say that, you know, we've gone from riches to rags in our life, and I would say that both Karen and I would say it's the best time of our life. And we would, if we had a time that we could live over again, that would be it. Because we were able to see that God provides. He provides just enough, just in time. And I would just say again, if you're a Christian, if you're not a Christian, you got bigger problems than this, because you are going to die. What are you going to do then? For those of us who are Christians, we just got to figure out a way to get through this life. you know, if you're a Christian, I would suggest something that would be very helpful to you, I think. And that is get George Mueller's autobiography. He kept a diary. This is a guy who created a massive organization to help orphans, and that was a big problem in Victorian England. I mean, you can see Charles Dickens wrote about it all the time. And it was a very, very big problem. The Industrial Revolution, massive poverty, kids on the street. I mean, there was an army of kids on the street. And he was a Christian pastor, and he started taking in some kids who were on the street. And they started taking in some more, but he didn't have any money. The guy was dirt poor, had nothing. And he would pray, and things would happen. He would have situations after he started, you know, getting a few more people, a few more kids, and he was responsible for feeding them. And he didn't have any money at all one day. You know, sometimes he'd get ahead, and sometimes he'd get behind. And, you know, they had absolutely nothing, no food and no money to buy food. And they set everybody down at the table. He prays for food, and then he gets a knock on the door, and it's a guy. First of all, he had his milk truck break down right outside the door. He said, "Hey, you want this milk? It's going to go bad." Similar thing happened with bread, same meal. You should read his book. All right, and joining us now is Eric Peters of epautos.com. Always a pleasure to talk to Eric, and we haven't talked for a while, and there's so much to talk about on his site. Again, epautos.com, and it is supported by volunteer contributions just like this show. So make sure you go there, check out the stuff, and if you want to keep the information coming about Liberty, about mobility, about real car reviews, and we're going to talk about some real car reviews, but we're going to start by talking about climate change, because they're circling back to that, and that's, you know, that was always the agenda. They pulled out a different panic for last year. They moved that agenda along quite a bit. It doesn't matter what the justification is. As long as they can strike fear into the heart of the general public, they can move on with their agenda. So now, after that's rolled on for a while, they're going to be bringing back climate change. And you've got an article, Who Killed the Electric Car? I had so many people used to send this to me years ago, that Michael Moore film, Who Killed the Electric Car? Yep. Well, who killed it? Eric, thank you for joining us.
Well, the free market did. Yeah. By the way, don't you just love these invisible boogeymen, whether it's the climate change or a sickness that doesn't kill 99% of us? But leaving that aside for the moment, Moore's film was about a car called the EV1, and it was one of the very first electric cars that came onto the market, and this was back in the mid-90s, and I test drove them. I'm one of the few journalists who's still working who can tell you that he's had seat time in the thing.
So what was it like?
And it failed for the same reason that electric cars continue to fail today. They cost too much, and they cost you too much time in terms of having to plan and orient your entire life around the electrical umbilical cord and worrying about, well, am I going to run out of juice, and where am I going to plug in, and how long am I going to have to wait? That's what killed the car. It wasn't the GM nefariously was trying to prevent people from buying it. Most people simply don't want to pay more to get less, which is what you get with the EV1 and almost all of the electric cars that are on the market today.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of the old turbine cars that Chrysler had. I mean, you know, they had the turbine cars just like the Batmobile on the TV series.
Sure.
And they were pretty cool, except they were unbelievably expensive. They're about five times the cost of a regular car.
Potentially, those could have worked. The main difficulty, as I understand it, with the turbine car was that it took a little while for the thing to spool up in order for you to get going, just like a jet airplane.
Yeah.
And potentially, they could have hammered that out. You know, the upside to a turbine-powered car is that just like a jet airplane, it can burn practically, you know, kerosene, diesel, you know, very easy-to-refine fuel that is readily available. So on that count, it could have worked very well. Now, we should talk about the electric car that did work, and that was killed as a result of an incredibly inept marketing job, and which
Before you go to that, though, I mean, when you look at the Michael Moore film, you know, Who Killed the Electric Car? It was very conspiratorial. You know, we had the evil automobile industry, we had the evil oil industry. They conspired to get rid of this thing that was a solution to all of mankind's woes, right? And yet, of course, Moore and his ilk, it's amazing to me how they've become big corporate cheerleaders with the vaccines, you know.
Censorship
of speech.
Master.
That's right.
They serve the same master, you know, ultimately. And, you know, if you dig into it a little bit, this becomes quite clear. Now, the car that we want to talk about is the Chevrolet Volt that GM actually produced up until recently. 2019 was the last year. And the genius of this thing was that it operated on the same principle that a diesel-electric locomotive operates on, in that it was what's called a series hybrid. You had a combustion engine, in this case a gas engine, on board, but it didn't propel the car. What it did was to click on and serve as a generator to keep the battery topped off so that you didn't have to stop. Now, the car's all-electric range was about 50 miles, which encompasses most people's daily drive without any difficulty. And if not, no big deal, because the gas engine would kick on and it would power up the battery and keep you going for as long as you wanted to go, including for several hundred miles. And then there was a related aspect to this, which is really interesting. The battery would never completely discharge because of the fact that it carried around its own onboard generator. So it wasn't worn out by these heavy discharge-recharge cycles, which anybody who knows anything about batteries knows inevitably reduces the service life of a battery. Now, with an electric car, you've got that problem, and then you've got the problem of, well, how do I get back on the road quickly? Then you bring out these so-called fast chargers that create an inherent fire hazard by trying to force-feed all of this high-voltage electricity back into the battery pack at an extremely rapid rate, which tends to cause overheating and thermal runaway and fires. You didn't have these issues with the Volt. The Volt was also pretty affordable. It was only slightly more than a conventional hybrid, and so people could afford to buy this thing. It made sense on economic grounds. It made sense on environmental grounds. It made sense all around. But it never got any love, and the reason for that is, oh, it's got a gas engine. It didn't matter that it burned hardly any gas. People who own these cars will tell you they have to put fuel stabilizer in the tank because a tank will last them 2 or 3 months. So, you know, it didn't emit any meaningful amount of gas. You know, gas is the dreaded carbon dioxide, so it would negligibly affect the climate changing, even if you buy into anthropomorphic climate change. So it was a perfect solution, and that was the problem. It actually worked.
Well, you know,
we can't have that.
We keep seeing how they're killing all internal combustion engines, even the scheme like you're talking about, where it's just used mm-hmm. as an occasional generator, they're being yep. phased out in these ultra-low emission zones in Europe. You know, they go yep. through a phase. First, they ban the diesel, then they ban the gasoline car, then yep. they ban the hybrid. They want yep. to go only to battery-operated electric cars. Let me ask you, the Toyota hybrids, do they have an engine that directly drives the car rather than just using it as a generator? Like the Prius?
Both, yeah, and all of the other hybrids that are on the road, the gas engine is actually connected to a transmission and directly drives the vehicle. So mm-hmm. the gas engine is not primarily there as a generator as it was in the Volt. And by the way, there's another aspect to this. You don't need this whole new parallel redundant infrastructure of so-called fast charging rigs when you have series hybrids like the Volt. You don't have to do any of that. So you eliminate the how many billions or trillions of dollars are they going to waste on something like that when you've got this vehicle that can just, you put a couple of gallons of gas in this thing, it had a 9-gallon tank. 9-gallon tank would probably last you a month, 2 months. An amazingly impressive car. And by the way, Volkswagen was working on a very similar concept using a diesel engine, and they were talking about 200 miles per gallon average when the diesel was running, and electric range of 100 miles or more.
Wow.
But, of course, again, we can't have that because it works.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. These engineers, especially the ones in Japan, are going out and coming up with workable solutions. They come in and say, you know what we're worried about? We're worried about emissions. Well, we can fix that. Worried about fuel economy. We can fix that. And then they come up with a solution and they ban it because that's not really what they want. You know, when you look at what we've just had here, you know, we've been scared that the world is going to end because of freezing. We were told it was going mm-hmm. to end because of warming. And then we're told it was just going to end because of climate change, and it's going to end because of the pandemic. And now they're back with the mm-hmm. so-called climate change. We know that none of this stuff is really what they're concerned about. What they're concerned about is just exercising control over us.
Absolutely. You notice the common thread, too, common denominator. You can look over at the whole thing that's going on with the Rona and its variants, which sounds like a punk rock band. But, you know, there are readily available, very affordable treatments for people if they get sick enough to need the treatment. That's all available. These vaccines are simply not necessary from a medical point of view. The masks are not necessary from a medical point of view. That, you know, as I was joking about a little bit when we began the interview, the best thing that you can do to avoid getting sick is to drop a few pounds if you're heavy. You know,
that's
don't
right.
be obese and don't eat bad food. Take care of yourself, and the odds are you won't even get sick.
Well, we know that there's something up when they're banning, and I talked a great deal in the last half hour about how they're trying to shut down ivermectin, even Merck, which
yep.
is still manufacturing it, but it's out of patent, so they're not making a lot of money. But they're restricting the flow of it. You have Walmart threatening, you know, giving out, telling their pharmacies, you need to engage with the person who prescribed this and tell them this is an FDA mm-hmm. approved and so forth. They're coming right up to the point where it'll be mm-hmm. banned, but the equivalent of the FDA in Japan is wringing their hands over the fact that they can't even get the supply, you know, because it's being mm-hmm. artificially restricted. So we know where that is. But getting back to the agenda with the electric cars, I remember mm-hmm. over a decade ago, I remember about the first time I heard of battery fires that burned down houses, and it happened a couple mm-hmm. of times just in North Carolina where Nissan Leafs doing mm-hmm. that. And now we've just had a major recall of a different GM,
Chevy Volts.
Yeah, the Chevy Volt.
60,000 of them.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, they're bringing those back for, what, about $1 billion or something? They're going to take a loss on that?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Amazing.
And what's not being discussed, and which people, I think, should understand, particularly if they're thinking about buying an electric car, is that this is a built-in inherent hazard with pure electric cars by dint of the nature of the charging apparatus, and particularly with regard to the fast charging. So, you know, if you don't want the hassle and the inconvenience of hooking it up to a 120-volt household outlet and waiting overnight, if you want to be able to get on the road again faster, and you're going to hook it up to one of these fast charging systems, that's where these things tend to catch fire.
Mm-hmm.
Because if there's any defect within the body of the cells, and a typical electric car has hundreds, if not thousands, of individual cells, any manufacturing defect, any crack, any problem, any dendrites that form, this is what causes the thermal runaway and fire.
Mm-hmm.
And it's clear, it's objective, it's not in dispute. Everybody who knows anything about the engineering and the way batteries are put together will tell you this is true. And they're not talking about it, which I think is extraordinarily interesting, because this is a legitimate, real public safety hazard. And if there were anything similar with regard to non-electric cars, if you had a vehicle out there that had an inherent design defect that resulted in it potentially catching fire, like the Pinto, for example,
yeah.
there would be a massive recall. They would have pulled these things off the road. And by the way, the Pinto, they made, I think, 3.2 million Pintos, and the number of Pintos that actually caught fire was incredibly small relative to the production, whereas the number of electric cars that have caught fire relative to the number of electric cars on the road, which is small, is pretty huge, and it's going to increase as more electric cars get forced down the gullets of Americans, like the pellets they stuffed down the throat of a pâté de foie gras goose.
That's exactly, our goose is cooked with this stuff, isn't it? I've talked about that many times in terms of the Boeing 737 MAX. You had two crashes. Mm-hmm. I don't know how many flights they had, the period of time where they were doing it, but you had two crashes and they shut it down. And so, you know, yep. We look at the number of people that died in those two crashes. It's a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of the reported number of deaths from these vaccines, but they just keep going. I said, do you think over 13,000 reported deaths just in America alone, not counting Europe, not counting the UK, do you think, and it's only half of Europe that they're keeping data on, do you think that you might have at least as many as they had there? But it doesn't matter about the planes. It doesn't matter about anything, because if they've got an agenda to get rid of the internal combustion engine, to get rid of your freedom, to alter society, they're going to go with it, and safety doesn't have anything to do with it.
Without question. You know, you see this dissonance, this disparity of attitude towards something, if it serves the agenda or it doesn't serve the agenda. There's all sorts of ululations about child safety, for example. Every kid has to be strapped into a safety seat because there's this, you know, very small chance that there might be an accident and you might result in the kid being hurt if the kid's not strapped into a safety seat. But hey, shoot them up with an experimental vaccine that is known, you know, to potentially cause crippling, if not killing, side effects. And that's somehow okay. Don't worry.
That's right.
About that.
Well, you know, you and I spotted this fraud from the very beginning because of the car stuff. And also because I had been watching Fauci and the pharmaceutical industry trying to scare people into getting an annual flu shot. And so, mm-hmm. But you spotted it just based on, you know, the lies in and around automobiles. It was pretty obvious if you've been following government closely on it. And I really do like that article again, because I think the key point that you made in that is the fact that very, very efficient in terms of the use of the internal combustion engine, very, very mm-hmm. little emissions, very little fuel used, and the batteries were always charged, so you don't have to worry about this fast charging, rapid charging thing, and the mm-hmm. batteries last longer because you're not cycling them through all the time. So that really was a solution, but of course, these people are absolutists about everything, aren't they, Matt? No internal combustion engine allowed in any way, shape, or form in any part of the design.
Well, and they're disingenuous absolutists, too. They won't come out and tell you that. They won't say, look, we're just going to take away your internal combustion engine because we don't like the fact that you have affordable, versatile mobility. They you know, instead they try to shame and guilt you about how if you don't do this, we're going to have catastrophic climate change and your children are going to drown as sea levels rise.
Yeah.
You know, it's of a piece with granny's going to die if you don't put on a face diaper.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's right. And, you know, you've talked many times about the useless, expensive things that they're adding, and of course they're planning on making everybody buy a breathalyzer, even though you're not an alcoholic and haven't been convicted multiple times, which used to be the conviction.
Oh, it's been done. It's part of the infrastructure bill that they passed. All the new cars are going to have this within, I think, 3 years.
Yeah, absolutely insane. Absolutely insane. But it's another complex thing that the car companies can sell, and they'll get massive funding from the government to put that in place. But you had an article, How Government Saves You Money. We talk about something that's a lot more subtle about that. Tell us a little bit about that safety aspect and how the government is saving us money.
Well, that was inspired by just doing a brake job recently. And if anybody who's listening to this has done a brake job recently, they'll know that in addition to changing pads, sometimes you have to deal with damaged brake rotors. That's the disc that the pads clamp onto that provides the friction that slows the car down. And sometimes, as a result of the pads having worn out, you'll have ruts in the surface of the rotor, and that has to be trued. And what they did in the past was to take the rotors off and put them onto a special lathe that machined them down to create a true surface so that the thing wouldn't pulsate when you pushed on the brake pedal. Problem is now, in order to save weight, they use much thinner gauge material that has to be replaced rather than machined. And the reason for that is that the car companies are so desperate to figure out ways to shave a pound here, a pound there, in order to comply with these federal fuel economy mandates that the government presents to us as they're saving you money. You know, the law that they just passed, the regulation that they just issued is going to increase car gas mileage by 2 or 3 or whatever it is. and people think about that and think, oh, that's wonderful. I'm going to save so much money at the pump. But what they don't realize is that they end up paying for things like new brake rotors rather than rotors that you could turn and machine for less. They don't realize that the gauge of the metal that's being used now for things like hoods and fenders is literally thinner than the flag that waves on the moon, and you can almost see it wave as you pick it up and, and hold it up with a little flimsy prop rod. You can literally, if you're a pretty strong man, you can bend it in half with your bare hands like Superman. And, you know, you and I can remember when exterior body panels were made of pretty sturdy heavy gauge metal, and you really had to hit the thing hard to cause any significant damage.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, you get into like a 10 or 15 mile an hour fender bender, well, what used to be a fender bender, and it takes off the whole front clip of the car.
Yeah.
Now, who pays for that? You do, in the form of higher insurance bills, not just the repair costs. Because the insurance companies aren't dumb. They have actuaries, and they look into what it's going to cost to fix your car if you wreck it or somebody hits you, and that's why you pay more. The current Ford F-150 has an entirely aluminum body. That shaves, I think, about 600 pounds off the weight of the vehicle. And that's great, unless you throw a heavy toolbox into the bed and dent it.
Yeah.
Or you back up into a tree and you crumple the tailgate. Aluminum is much harder to fix, and sometimes it can't be fixed, versus steel. And it requires a whole separate clean room in the body shop, and it requires special welding skills that a guy who just welds steel may not have. And, of course, that, too, is reflected in repair costs and insurance costs. And all these things cumulatively add up to a lot of money to save you on gas.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's amazing as they make this all more expensive to own, expensive to buy, all these different regulatory issues. And, of course, again, you know, when we just talk about this breathalyzer thing, I just absolutely irritates me. I'm not in the market for a new car. You know, when I look at that and think about the fact that somebody like me that doesn't even drink will be compelled to have a breathalyzer in their car, it's just absolutely insane. Perfect example of a bloat, of corruption in our regulatory agencies. The only thing I can see about the lightweight rotors, of course, is that it takes down your unsprung weight, which brings us to our next our next topic here, and that's the Miata that you had to evaluate.
Yeah.
And you got a review of a Miata. You do car reviews of real cars that people can afford to buy. Tell us your impressions of my favorite type of car. I don't have I don't have the fourth generation Miata. I've got the third generation. It's about 12 years old, but I like it a lot, and I'm not even looking to upgrade it. I like it enough. So, but tell us about the new one and what you thought about it.
Well, sure. The Miata, it's one of those cars. Sometimes I feel like a guy who is out swimming in the open expanse of the Pacific Ocean, and every once in a while there's an island, and I swim for it, and I manage to crawl up on the beach and rest and take a breath before I have to start swimming again. And that's how I feel when I get a car like the Miata in between all of these homogenized transportation appliance crossovers that are proliferating, and they're all the same other than the badge and a few other things like whether the touch screen is 11 inches or 12 inches and stuff like that. But the Miata harkens back to the old Rush song, The Better Vanished Time, when cars were still fun.
Yeah.
And this is a very fun car, and more than that, it's a connected car. And I use that term very specifically because it's not connected in the modern sense, i.e. with all of this electronic second-guessing and peremptory parenting. You connect to the car physically.
That's right.
There is almost no electronic interference. You know, there's this wonderful 6-speed mechanical shifter that connects mechanically via the rods and levers to that transmission that's in the floor plan. You've got that brilliant engine up in front that you control, and you put this thing on like a suit, and you just go for a drive. And even the top, it's wonderful. There's no electronic motors. You know, if you want to take the top down, there's a catch up at the top of the windshield. You pull the catch down, you throw the top back. That's it.
Yeah. And it's not like the convertible that I had when I met Karen. We were in college. I had a Triumph Spitfire. Now that was an adventure of rugged at the edge because it was not made that well. It wasn't very reliable, unlike the Miata. And the top, you could throw the top down, but boy, if you tried to put it back up, it was an exercise and snaps that were going to break, and you had to stretch them and all the rest of the stuff. Whereas the Miata, you just throw the thing back and pull it back up. It's great.
Those old Triumphs and MGs and all of those British cars were all kinds of fun
when they
worked.
They were, yeah.
When they worked.
Yeah. It was a love-hate relationship.
The Miata,
it was a love-hate relationship.
The Miata is, is that it is as well built and as reliable as a Toyota Corolla.
That's
right. It is a car that you can, and you know this personally, you can do track days in this thing, and it will not break. You may have to put new tires on it if you have a fun day. But other than that, and you can drive it to work, and it gets 35 miles per gallon if you don't work it too hard.
That's right.
And it'll go 200,000 miles before it needs any kind of significant work, sometimes longer than that. And you can pick up one for about $25,000-$26,000 brand new. There's literally nothing about this car not to like.
That's right. Yeah, you talk about track days. When I worked, the commute that I have, driving in at 4 o'clock in the morning on backcountry roads during the middle of a pandemic, every day was a track day, Eric. It was a blast. And then when I'd have to come home, there'd be traffic, and I'd have to wait for people in slow-moving trucks that are dropping rocks. You know, I had to go through a lot of windshields because of where we live. But, you know, when I was driving home, I would just take the top down and just relax. It was a completely different car. You basically would convert it to a completely different type of car. So it could be, you know, a racer or it could be just a, you know, a cruiser. And that was the thing that was nice about it. It is very small, as you point out. You do wear it. You do put it on, and there's not a lot of room to put things. I like the comment that you had. You said, get some cargo pants because you're going to need the pockets to store stuff in.
You know, interestingly, the car gets slammed for not having a lot of storage capacity, but that's only partially true. Inside, as you know, there's not a lot of room for stuff. Mazda doesn't even put a center console in it to speak of. There's something, you know, behind, between the seats that you can toss a few things in.
Yeah.
But the trunk is actually kind of remarkably roomy. As part of my chicken coop project, I had to get some drainage rocks, and I put four bags of drainage rocks in the trunk, and I could have probably put two more in there, and it was no problem.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you use that kind of stuff all the time. But the key thing about it is, as you pointed out, you know, most of the cars have become appliances. You know, they're people movers or whatever. And this is a car that really connects you to the road. It connects you to the environment. It connects you to the driving experience. And it's just a lot of fun. And we just don't have that anymore. You know?
It's very sad.
Yeah, it is. And you can afford it.
We used to take cars like this for granted. You know, these were the kinds of cars that you and me and people of a certain vintage, you know, who were born before the 90s, before everything started to turn sour, took for granted and helped us to fall in love with the car and to appreciate how fun it could be to just jump in the car and, you know, go pick up your girlfriend and go, you know, hit a backcountry road somewhere, maybe just stop here, stop there, wherever you felt like it, and just enjoy the drive.
Yeah.
We've lost that, and it's a very sad thing.
Oh, yeah, it absolutely is. And it, again, you know, it's just, if you haven't done something, like, you point out that there really aren't any competitors left. That Toyota's and the Toyota Subaru, was it the BRZ?
Yeah,
or what, you know.
the 86 and the BRZ. But they're bringing out an updated version of that for 22, hopefully.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if they don't can it, you know.
But,
you know, and then your other alternative are real expensive exotic cars like Corvettes and Porsches. And, you know, it just, you know, it's just a great car that's available, and again, if you get a used one, the new ones are not that expensive compared to most cars, but the used ones are real affordable if you can find them.
Yeah, oh, you can pick up a ready-to-go one for around $8,000 to $10,000.
Yeah. There's one other thing I would mention, and that's something that I've done a lot of, and that is the fact that because there were so many of them, and because people are connected to it as a driver's car, there's such an amazing aftermarket of parts that you can go in and modify stuff on it. And it had a great suspension, and it handled great, but I made it even better with suspension upgrades that I did years ago with bracing underneath and things. Because always with a convertible, the issue is shimmy and things like that. And the more rigid the frame, the better it's going to handle. So there's a lot of things like that. It's just an amazing variety of things that are out there. It turns it into kind of a Swiss Army knife. You can do anything that you want to with it.
You know? Yeah, Mazda made it very wrenchable, which you know, again, from personal experience. It's not a hyper-complicated car like, you know, the current Corvette with its mid-engine design and all of that, and you practically have to be an engineer and have engineering tools to do anything on that car. The Miata is a thing you can, you know, put the jack underneath of it and put some bracing on it, do this, do that. It's something that anybody with a basic tool set can have a lot of fun with.
Yeah. You know, I think back to a quote that I heard Rowan Atkinson say one time. The guy plays Mr. Bean and a lot of other things.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got a lot of money, and he's a car aficionado, and so he can afford these hypercars, these super expensive cars. But there was kind of a sadness about it. He said, I don't really like what they've become. He said, you don't really so much drive them as you manage them. Because there's so much that's being done automatically, and it disconnects you from the car. And it's like, well, you need to get rid of that $3 million car and go out and buy a $3,000 Miata. You'll be connected again. You have a blast.
In addition to that, another thing to know about the Miata relative to these hypercars, the hypercars now, their performance is so extreme that in order to even begin to plumb the depths of what they're capable of, you have to operate at speeds and in a manner that even for a guy like me, and I drive pretty fast, is a bit much to do on the street.
Yeah, you can't. Yeah,
puts you at risk and puts others at risk. Whereas this Miata, you can have all kinds of fun operating at perfectly reasonable speeds, and that's exhilarating. Every single time you go for a drive in that car, you're having a good time.
Yes.
Whereas there's nothing, I think, more depressing, at least to me as a car guy, than moping along at 65 miles an hour in a car like a Corvette that does 200 miles an hour.
That's exactly right. Yeah, driving a slow car fast. And the thing is, when you put the... You know, back in the day when we used to roll windows down, things like that, you would get a sense of what was happening in the environment, and it also made it feel like the car was going faster because of the noise, because of the wind, and so forth. And so that's why I would say, you know, I would take the top down. If I got in slow-moving traffic or something like that, I would take the top down. Automatically, it felt like I was going another 20, 30 miles faster because and so it helps to ameliorate that. I've had situations where, and I haven't really done much to upgrade the engine on it, it's not slow. It's certainly safe for interstate acceleration and things like that. But it's really more of a momentum car. But I've had situations where I was really laying into it, shifting through the gears, and all of a sudden I see a cop. And it's like, whoa! And I look down. I'm doing the speed limit.
Right.
It's like you gotta love that.
It's a much more common car. And you know the virtue again is circle back to the mileage. These hypercars will kill you on gas.
Oh yeah.
Whereas, you know, this Miata, it's like, you know, you're driving a little Toyota Corolla. You know, it's extremely practical.
Yeah.
And something else about it that I want to touch on, I was out driving with my girlfriend, and we hit a rain squall. And as long as you're moving, it's amazing how well-designed that car is. The rain will not enter the passenger compartment as long as you're moving.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, yeah, I know that experience. I had mine has got third generation, so it's got electric top that comes up, a hard top.
Mm-hmm.
And we would have that situation until we came to a spot where we had to stop sign or something like that, or a red light. And then it'd be raining hard, and it wouldn't get in on us, you know. But then we would stop, and then you had to wait 12 seconds for the thing to come
that's
up.
That's why I like the manual top. I mean, you literally can just reach behind you and that's pull it up, and you're fine.
That's right. Yeah, what we did with it was we found there's an aftermarket thing you can buy that allows you to raise the top while you're still going up to 30 miles an hour, 30, 35, whatever it is. And, and so with that, that solved the problem because I can keep the thing moving while I get the top up. And so, you know, and like I said, there's all kinds of customization stuff that's out there. I want to talk about your chicken coop you're in the process of building. You did an article about the coop in progress, and you pointed out that you used the you didn't really want to use the Miata that much. You got your pickup truck for the big boards, although you did use it for some supplies for the chicken
coop. You know what,
though?
I'll say this too, and probably Mazda, I don't know whether they'll like this or not, because it's both good and bad.
Mm-hmm.
I was able to actually take two 4x4x8 boards home with me in the Miata, of course, with the top down.
Yeah.
they rode shotgun with me, posts.
Yeah, that's great. There's always a way to do it. You know, that's, as they say, the traction for Miata is always the answer. I mean, even for getting some poles home for your chicken coop. I say that Miata stands for mine is a tiny auto. That's that's my expression.
That's hilarious.
But tell us about your.
I'm going to have to remember that one.
Tell us about your chicken
coop. This chicken thing, I'm trying to get my new coop done before I can't get lumber any longer without having to provide proof of jab to get it at Home Depot or Lowe's.
I know.
A lot of people, I'm concerned about the direction the country's headed in, and in particular, I'm concerned about supply chain interruptions. I'm worried about further lockdowns, and most of all, of being in a situation where the government can pressure me via food to do things like roll up my sleeve to get a jab. So,
and that's coming.
I'm stepping up my chicken and duck. I have both operation and building this new coop, both to provide food in the form of eggs and meat for myself. But I'm also considering potentially making it sort of a side gig and having, because my chickens and ducks are free range. They're out wandering my property all day, and there's actually quite a market for free range eggs and free range pastured meat as well.
Absolutely.
So it's something that people who are listening to this, if they're able to do it, might want to consider doing, both for their own families and potentially as something that they can use to barter and even make some money doing.
That's right. Yeah, every, you know, whatever you do, whether you're raising tomatoes or you've got chickens that are laying eggs, you always wind up with more than you can use. And it's always a way to do a market. And this is one of the key things. This is why I wanted to talk about it. Because as those of us who do not want to take the experimental jab are being excluded from everything, and make no doubt about it, it is coming. We've already seen, and again, you know, the people who are at the forefront of all this in America, New York City, L.A., and in New York City, they shut everything down but the grocery stores. But in L.A., the L.A. City Council wanted to shut down the grocery stores as well. They've already done that in France and in other places. So this is not a theory. This is a global agenda. It's rolling out at different speeds around the world based on resistance. The way I described it yesterday, Eric, I said it's like an electric circuit. They've got the same potential everywhere. And the difference in the current at the rate at which this is flowing is your variable resistance. And so we need to turn up our resistance all the way to stop. But if that doesn't happen, we are going to be shut out of even getting groceries. And so it's important for people to understand that not only can you feed yourself, but you can start to establish a barter network where we can start to operate outside of this corporate governance that is worldwide. And this is true of everybody in every country.
No question. Self-sufficiency to the degree possible and decentralization to the degree possible. Forming our own parallel structures, our own societies, people that we deal with and who deal with us as free-range, healthy human beings. Yeah. That's one of the ways that we can push back against this. And this is a burgeoning movement. It's becoming very popular. In my own area, there are lots of people who are doing this that I'm connected with. And from what I gather all around the country, it's the same thing. And it's well and good to continue to protest and to resist what's going on in the cities and the suburbs. But at the same time, I think it behooves us to make provisions for ourselves to ride this out.
That's right. Yeah, they're going to coop us up, so we better get busy with our chicken coops.
Yep.
Because
you know, or a garden. You know, tailor it to your situation.
Yeah,
whatever,
that's right.
Whatever works for you, and whatever you have the time and the expertise and are willing to do. Just so long as you're doing something, do not be caught with your proverbial pants down.
That's right. Yeah, and you know, even if you have a situation where you've got a lot of chickens and you've got a lot of eggs and. And you're basically just on an egg diet, you know, that's better than nothing at all. And you'll be able to find other people who have complementary products that you'll be able to barter and to trade with, I think. A good example.
Well, if you store up.
Go ahead.
Yeah, store up some rice, store up some beans and various other vegetables, and you can use the eggs to supplement and to have the protein. That's the element that they give you, along with the vitamins that are contained within the eggs.
Yeah.
So it's not just an egg diet. You know, you can actually have a very wholesome and nutritional diet with eggs providing the primary protein source.
That's right. Yeah, I've interviewed a couple of times a guy that's got a website, civildefensemanual.com, and he's got a couple of really detailed manuals about survival. And one of the things he talks about is that if you have freshly laid eggs, not the ones that you get from the grocery store that are washed, but freshly laid eggs, he said you can store those things up for 2 years without refrigeration with a certain preparation process that he talks about in his book that is traditional. You know, he said you talk about the cowboys used to go on camping trips and how they would take eggs with them. How'd they do that? How'd they keep them fresh? Well, there's a way that you can do that. And so there's a lot of different things out there, and there's a lot of things that you can play up ahead of time. Yeah.
Well, now that you mention it, I this is an important point. When an egg is laid by a bird, it has something called the bloom, which is a coating. If you have ever seen an egg that was just laid, you'll see it. There's a wetness around the egg. And nature designed that so that the egg will not go bad. So you can take a freshly laid egg, and as long as you don't wash it, you can keep it on the kitchen table for days, if not weeks, and it's perfectly safe to eat it.
That's right. Yeah, and you can do a few more things to prepare it, and you can keep it for years, you know, according to his book. So, again, all these different things. He's not a sponsor, but I just mentioned he's got some great advice there at that site. Yeah, when we went up to New York, we were going to try to stop by and see you, but we had problems with our rental car. I had a set of those books I wanted to give to you that I thought you would get a lot out of it. But we'll get it to you somehow, one way or the other.
Well, the next time you're up here, I should actually have the thing finished and up and running.
Well, there's always other things that you can do, right? The preparation
this
never ends.
Well, yeah, the next thing after I get this done, I've decided to build a proper greenhouse with solar panels and the whole works so that once that's done, I'll have the ability to provide year-round vegetables and meat. And even if the world doesn't go to pot, this is, I think, a really wonderful thing to have because it's nutritious. It's far better than the stuff that you're getting, the GMO, chemically laced stuff
yes.
that they're trying to sell you at the grocery store that is making everybody sick.
That's right. Yeah, and that brings up another point. I've talked about this a lot. You know, whether you're talking about the food that you're eating or whether you're talking about educating your children, I think what we're going to find, if we're able to get this stuff together, I think we're going to find that even though we might have a little bit simpler life, we're going to enjoy it more. Which goes back
Absolutely.
To what we were just talking about, the sports cars, right? You could have a very, very complex, very expensive, very high-tech sports car, but you can also enjoy an older one that you can pick up for a couple $1,000s used, and it can actually be a more enjoyable experience. And I think people are going to find that in terms of teaching their kids, in terms of growing their own food, in terms of having the kind of independence and freedom. And this goes back, mm-hmm. Eric, to the kind of society, you know, Jefferson said, that he believed that an agrarian society was essential for a climate of liberty because
yes.
of that kind of independence that people had. And he said, you know, he was very down on cities. He said they're a threat to the health, the wealth,
yep.
and the liberty of man. And that's what the globalists want to pack us into, is into cities, into little tiny crates where we're connected through a metaverse, a virtual reality to each other, and only connected through their portals. That's the world that they want to have for us.
It's alienating.
It is.
It's very alienating. One of my favorite writers is the sci-fi writer Robert Heinlein, and one of the quotes that he had that I very much like is that specialization is for ants. And what he meant by that is that human beings are naturally happier in a versatile environment where they have control over most of the factors that affect their lives.
That's right.
So this, to get back to this idea of connectedness, after we get off the phone, I'm going to walk out to my current chicken coop and I'm going to collect eggs.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to go down to the store to buy them. I'm just going to collect eggs from my birds that walk on my land, and then I'm going to see them walk around, and it gives me a sense of connectedness to my land and to the food that I eat. And I find this to be very, very gratifying on a
yes.
on a spiritual level.
Yes,
you know, this is a healthy and good thing, and we've lost that. And I think, as people experience it, they realize, wow, this is kind of nice, you know, to not be staring at a cell phone all day, but to actually watch a sunset, for example, to go for a walk in the woods,
yes.
To do something with your kids outside instead of sitting in front of the idiot box and listening to Dr.
That's
Fauci.
Right. That's right. Yeah, exactly. I think we're going to find that we're going to have something, but we need to keep our freedom. And you know, freedom to be able to do what we want. But we don't want the freedom to participate in their society, in their institutions, in their corporations, and to eat their processed food and to take their medicine and the rest of this stuff. I think we're going to find that the things are going to be better. I also wanted to talk to you because I saw a picture of Harry Brown on one of your articles.
Mm-hmm.
Harry Brown, yep. I got to know Harry Brown while I was running for Congress back in 1996.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a quote from him: government is force, pure and simple. There is no way to sugarcoat that. And because government is force, it will attract the worst elements of society.
That's right.
People who want to use government to avoid having to earn their living and to avoid having to persuade others to accept their ideas voluntarily. Boy, we're having that in spades, aren't
mm-hmm.
we? Force ruins everything is the title of your article.
Talk sure. It attracts pathological people.
Yeah.
You know, think about that. You know, the kind of person who wants to lord it over somebody else. When we were kids, we recognize such people. We call them bullies.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, now we elect them. And, you know, if you can see extreme examples of this, obvious examples of this, in the persons of people like Cuomo in New York and Newsom in California.
Yep.
But all of them, fundamentally, they're possessed of this attitude that they are our masters. They know best. And our job is simply to submit and defer to their superior judgment over us.
Yes. That's right. That's right. Yeah, Harry Brown had I remember his book was How I Found Freedom in an Unfree World. You know, talking about getting out of it, and I think that's what we're all going to find, and we're being forced into this. And I think that's going to be ultimately, it's going to be a difficult transition to make for many of us. You've got an article talking about how GM is now forcing everybody out of the company, but this is happening everywhere.
Yep.
I think a big part of this, you know, not just General Motors, but, you know, we're seeing this happening everywhere. We're seeing it happening even in the military. I think a large part of this is that they want to have an excuse to kick people out. To
sure.
get them out of off of the payroll, to get them off of, to some degree or the other, in the case of the military, in many cases, off of the retirement benefits. And they want to reduce the workforce. They want to put everybody on universal basic income as a handout. And they can blame it on COVID, and they can use the vaccine
yep.
as a weapon to make it happen.
Sure. You know, in a way, though, this could be healthy for us. I think most of us, to one degree or another, have made accommodation or made peace with these little petty infringements and usurpations that we all deal with, ranging from income taxes all the way down the line, seatbelt laws, you name it. We figure, well, you know, on balance, overall, I'm able to earn my living, I'm able to pay my bills, so I'll put up with this. It's becoming intolerable, though. It's becoming impossible for people to put up with it.
Right.
And that is what's propelling us to decide, you know what, I've had my fill of this, and I'm going to opt out of this.
That's right.
I'm going to figure out a way to assert my own freedom and my own judgment in my own life and with my family and with my friends, and that's the end of it. And that's how we get our power back, by just not having anything to do with them anymore.
That's right. And when you raise your chickens and your eggs and when you grow your vegetables and that sort of thing, your labor is untaxed, what you're investing in that.
Yep.
Unlike when you're working for your employer and you're getting hit with all this stuff, and all of a sudden it's like, where did it all go?
You get the full value of your investment in time, money, and effort.
That's right. But we're still going to have to hang together collectively to defend individual liberty. I like that expression, because if we don't, the goons and the thugs will not leave us alone. They will come to our individual homesteads, and they will destroy the gardens, they'll destroy the chicken coops, and they'll throw us into some kind of a detention camp because we're somehow terrorists for being outside of their system. So we're still going to have to fight them politically. Even if you're not interested in government, and I'm not interested in having anything to do with government, even though I ran for Congress, I certainly didn't want to win. it's the sort of thing you have to, you may not be interested in it, but they're interested in you. And they're going to single you out. And so from a defensive standpoint, these people who are constantly invading our lives in one way or the other, we have to keep an eye on them. We have to know what they're going to do, and we have to act together to try to stop that. That's the key thing.
I think as a psychological question, we have to rescind moral sanction. We have to stop accepting guilt and blame. We're not the problem. We're not the bad people. They are.
Yeah.
We're not killing Granny. We're not fouling the climate. All of this is nonsense designed to make us feel shameful and make us willing to accept these unreasonable and tyrannical things. And we've got to stop doing that.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. Shame is their big game. Shame and peer pressure, that's what we see on social media with all this stuff. And it's like, go ahead, call me names. It doesn't really bother me.
But there are
other things that they can do, and that's the thing that we need to be concerned about other than the shame. The shame and the groupthink that is out there, that's easily dismissed, but we have to be get over that individually. But the big thing is still their collective power. So that's the thing
we have
to keep an eye on. But it's great to hear that you're making progress through with your chicken coop. Glad to hear that. It's been great talking to you. And just to talk a little bit about living life normally and just driving a real car.
Absolutely. Let's do it again soon.
We will. All right. Thank you very much.
And I will send you some pictures.
Okay. That sounds great. Eric Peters, epautos.com. Mobility, liberty, and practical car reviews. We're going to be right back. Stay with us. Has your news been censored, banned over and over again? Has vital information been held prisoner by mainstream and anti-social media? It's the duty of every thinking person to make the great escape to thedavidknightshow.com. There you'll find links to live streams, videos, audio podcasts, and support links. Live stream the show at DLive and Trovo every Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. Eastern. Videos at BitChute and YouTube. New audio podcast, The Real David Knight Show, at Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, iHeart, Spotify, and more. But even though there's a light at the end of the tunnel, without your support, the show will run out of gas. The links to support the show are at thedavidknightshow.com. To donate via Subscribestar, donate via or donate via Cash App, Bitcoin, or P.O. Box. Our sincere thanks to all of you who have stood with us to get this far. Please don't forget to share the links and pray for the country as well as our family.
Elvis.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles.
And the sweet sounds of Motown. Find them on the Oldies channel at APSradio.com.
this thing from Mitt Romney saying that your freedoms, your liberty threatens my health. So I retweeted that, and this is what I had to say. The vexed. Some of them are double vexed, soon triple vexed, but they will never be at peace with themselves or with others. Mitt Romney is free to imprison himself, to inject himself, to indulge in his OCD paranoia. But this oath breaker does not have the authority to remove my informed consent. And boy, did that get, I only had like 94 retweets, but I got 102. Pretty much, there were a couple of people who agreed with me, but for the most part, most people were eagerly anticipating the day that I was going to die from COVID. Well, keep wishing. I didn't do anything last year. I didn't go through any of the rituals at all anywhere last year. Still not interested in doing that. But I was absolutely amazed at the pushback. Some people were saying things like, Mitt Romney is absolutely right here. Herd immunity depends on 70-80% of a population getting vaccinated. Romney is to be commended on conserving the body politic and criticizing crank libertarians. You do live in a society. Well, a social contract is something in which I cannot find my signature, but I do recall Mitt Romney taking an oath to support that constitution. Going back to Romney, here's what he had to say. Headline from the Salt Lake Tribune. Your liberty affects my health. The Utah senator would implement vaccine mandates if he was still in private business. And so what he says in the article, he says, the people who are vaccine hesitant are also authority hesitant. That's right, because this is not about science or medicine. This is about political power. And we're hesitant about the authority. I've said many times, even if I believed that this was 100% safe and 100% effective, I would still oppose it being mandated. I would still oppose a system of vaccine, present your papers, please, passports everywhere. To live life as a condition of government-granted privilege, that is far more dangerous than any real pandemic. And this is not a real pandemic when about 25% of the people are affected by this and die from this, skewed towards the elderly, by their own data, if you believe their data. And we know their data is inflated. Again, they can't distinguish, and they admit it. The PCR tests do not distinguish between COVID, between flu, between cold, between RSV. They certainly do not distinguish between variants. And they don't have the tests and aren't using them to make the distinction between the variants. So he says the people who are vaccine hesitant are also authority hesitant. You know, the founders of America were authority hesitant, Mitt. That Constitution that you swore to uphold, that was there because they don't trust people in authority. He said they don't trust the media. They don't trust politicians when they say vaccines are a good idea. Neither did the founders of this country. This country was not based upon trust of politicians. We have different branches of governments and a division of power and checks and balances because we know that politicians of all people cannot be trusted. We know that, as Madison said, men are not angels, which is why we have government. But because they're not angels, we must, you know, have these checks and balances on them, as you had... others say, Patrick Henry said, guard anybody who approaches the precious jewel of liberty, especially somebody like Mitt Romney. I wouldn't let him come near my dog. We've seen what he does to dogs. Don't trust politicians, he said. When they say the vaccines are a good idea, we should trust them when they say they're a good idea. He said they tune it out and they turn to the internet where they can find people who are anonymous giving them bad information. I'm not anonymous, Romney. I sent that tweet to you. Maybe that's one of the reasons why I had all your little bots saying I need to be kicked off. I need to die. Because I sent it directly to you, Mitt. I hope you saw it. Romney says local school board should be allowed to decide the best course of action for students. See? No parents. This guy is a dyed-in-the-wool global authoritarian. The only difference between Mitt Romney and Donald Trump is the fact that Mitt Romney owns it. Donald Trump is still deceiving you. We should keep the decision-making as close to the people as possible, but not with the parents, not with that sphere of authority. People say, I want my liberty. Well, your liberty affects my health. And when that occurs, we have to come to some sort of agreement. Well, I do not agree. We have a constitution that says that. And, of course, history has told us that those who give up their liberty for the promise of safety deserve neither. Franklin said that, and history has shown that they get neither either. You wind up, when you try to trade off your liberty for security and safety, you wind up with nothing, nothing. Because to the degree that you give up your liberty, to that degree you become a slave. Slaves are not safe. Slaves are not secure. Slaves are not prosperous. And so every time you try to feed another finger to the shark, or a hand, or an arm, every time you do that, you're worse off than you were before. The Common Man. They created Common Core to dumb down our children. They created Common Pass to track and control us. Their Commons Project to make sure the commoners own nothing. And the communist future. They see the common man as simple, unsophisticated, ordinary. But each of us has worth and dignity created in the image of God. That is what we have in common. That is what they want to take away. Their most powerful weapons are isolation, deception, intimidation. They desire to know everything about us while they hide everything from us. It's time to turn that around and expose what they want to hide. Please share the information and links you'll find at thedavidknightshow.com. Thank you for listening. Thank you for sharing. If you can't support us financially, please keep us in your prayers. thedavidknightshow.com.
I mean, that's what we've been talking about from the beginning. This Gates has these incestuous relationships with Anthony Fauci that go back 20 years, where he's, you know, paying Fauci, and they have all kinds of really corrupt financial entanglements with each other. They, you know, he brought Fauci to his house in 2000, and his $189 million house in Seattle brought him into the den. Sat him down and said, I want to have a partnership with you. The way that Fauci explains it is that Fauci would develop the drugs.
This kind of government knows how to help business, to encourage it.
Pass them on to the drug companies, to Merck, Sanofi, Gilead, Johnson & Johnson. Gates would then guarantee markets in Africa through his control of WHO.
Wow.
We have now what we have always needed, real partnership with the government.
Because he controls WHO, he controls those countries, because WHO pays for their health ministries and supplies all their HIV medications, and they have to do what WHO tells them to do. So he can require those countries to buy the vaccines from these companies, and he then is invested in the companies, in Merck. He owns, you know, and by the way, Gates has no pretension that he gives a crap about public health. His other investments are in tobacco companies, in processed foods, in Coca-Cola, in Cargill, in Monsanto, Philip Morris, Kraft, you know, cheese, and then all the oil companies, which he owns stakes in virtually all of them. So he's not a guy who cares about climate or who cares about public health. He's a guy who cares about control.
Republican leader on the House Energy and Commerce Committee Subcommittee on Health. This is how bureaucratic Congress is. This guy's name is Brett Guthrie. He's from Kentucky. He's also on the House Energy and Committee Commerce. This is somebody else there that's a commerce leader. So these people put out a joint statement. Guthrie and this other person who is part of Energy and Commerce, Kathy McMorris Rogers. She's from Washington. They put out a statement that said this approval, the FDA approval that we've talked about before, whether it's approval or not, they're saying this approval will build more confidence and trust in the vaccines, which are safe and highly effective at preventing severe illness, hospitalization, and death from COVID-19. For anyone who hasn't yet been vaccinated, we encourage you to talk to your doctor. Does it matter if my doctor says I don't need to get it? No. Getting vaccinated, they say, is the best way to protect yourself and your family. It's how we beat this pandemic and restore our way of life. Life under this pandemic has been full of fear. Yeah, I noticed. Fear being sold by you, people like you. You sell out Republican politicians and the bureaucrats. It's been full of fear. Fear of the unknown, isolation, and uncertainty. What gave us hope from the beginning was the promise of American ingenuity and innovation. What they're talking about here is corporate worship. Well, let me rephrase that. Worshiping corporations, because, you know, when churches get together, they call it corporate worship sometimes. No, they're talking about worshiping corporations, worshiping technology. And they're also talking about, from the very beginning of this, our hope was that we would have a vaccine. There was never any interest in any therapeutic. Anytime somebody would, any doctor would say, hey, I've got something here that works. We're not going to do that. Arrest that guy. Kick him off of social media. Take his license away from him. They never wanted anything but a vaccine. They're going to lock everybody down as draconian measures as possible. Wait until we have a rushed vaccine. And that has been the plan since dark winter 2001. And they've rehearsed that, as I've said many times, every year for 20 years. So we've got the Arkansas and Ohio governors also saying that they hope, they place their hope in the FDA full approval of the vaccine. And they hope that that will get you to get the injection. So this is Asa Hutchinson and Mike DeWine, people who have betrayed us time and again. Mike DeWine, one of the worst of the governors, a Republican in Ohio. And then Asa Hutchinson, who was pretending that he was along with Republicans and saying, yeah, I'm going to stop these mask mandates. And then after he got some criticism from the establishment press, it's like, oh, I'm so sorry I signed that. I wish I hadn't done it. But, you know, we're hoping that the judiciary will overturn that bad law that I signed. And, yes, they did. So they're out there now celebrating Asa Hutchinson, governor of Arkansas, Mike DeWine, governor of Ohio, both Republicans, both traitors to liberty and the Constitution, celebrating this lie, this fraudulent declaration of authorization from the FDA. Some people are not being vaccinated, said Mike DeWine, who would be vaccinated, and so those people are going to die. But now we can save their life with a rubber stamp from a lying federal bureaucracy. Well, let me just say Mike DeWine, it's none of your business, really, right? You're not a doctor, first of all. You're not even a governor who obeys the Constitution. Why would I listen to you? Why would I care what you have to say? You sell out. In Ohio, GOP Senator Andrew Brenner pushed through a last-minute provision that would prohibit state public schools and universities from mandating vaccines without a full FDA approval. He said, when I introduced this amendment, I was looking at it from the standpoint of individual liberty. While it had been given emergency use authorization, typical vaccines take about 10 years of trials and testing to know the side effects and everything. And so they say, however, the COVID-19 vaccines were the result of more than a decade of behind-the-scenes research and huge injections of funding. Injections of money. Yeah, that's what Trump did with his Trump shots. Huge injection of money that laid the groundwork for them to be rolled out so quickly. Let me just say this. Again, if you're going to say, and he knows what the situation is, Andrew Brenner, He knows that it typically takes a very long time. And as Newsweek is pushing back against this and saying, oh, yeah, we were laying the groundwork for this for 10 years, Moderna was the only company that was pushing on mRNA. They had never gotten a therapeutic or a vaccine approved. No other pharmaceutical company was even interested in that approach until Fauci and Trump injected cash into it. They all said it was too dangerous, it was too risky. Christy Noem, South Dakota. She said, if Joe Biden illegally mandates vaccines, I will take every action available under the law to protect South Dakotans from the federal government. Virtue signaling again. So if he mandates vaccines, and let me just say, and I had this going back and forth with people on social media, people contacting me, well, you better hope that Trump gets in because Biden will mandate this. I said, they're going to roll this through with corporate coercion. And that's going to be pretty widespread before they ever attempt to mandate it. They'll attempt to mandate it for the final few people, perhaps, at some point in time in the future. But that was never the intention. New England Journal of Medicine said, we don't want to have the due process challenges. We want to do this through corporate coercion. The same approach that they've used to take our free speech in the First Amendment, to pretend that it's corporations who are doing it and they can do whatever they want. The government is using corporations as a surrogate for all of this tyranny, whether it's taking away the First Amendment or taking away our informed consent and our parental rights and everything else that goes along with this. Private property, as they're putting on these moratoriums on people with rent. They're using corporate surrogates for their tyranny. And so when Christy Noem does this, she knows that. And it is simply window dressing. South Dakota legislators, as a matter of fact, have urged her to put in a vaccine mandate ban. But she's not doing that. The bill would effectively ban COVID vaccine mandates under any and all circumstances in South Dakota. So she's saying, I'm going to protect you if Joe Biden mandates vaccines. But she won't sign on to the bill that the Republican legislature has put in there saying you stop the employers from doing it. You understand? She knows that that's where this is going to roll out. Fauci knows. Everybody knows that. I knew that. I've been telling you that for a year and a half. That's where it's coming from. The New England Journal of Medicine said that. So on that point, on the reality, at the point of the attack with corporate coercion on these vaccines, she's going to resist it. While she virtue signals on the internet, saying, I'm going to protect you from Biden mandates, she allows the corporations to do it. And so she says, hey, you know, you've got other jobs that you could do. Well, I would suggest maybe she's got another job she could do. Maybe she's not really very well suited to being a governor, especially a Republican governor, posing as somebody who supports individual liberty in the Constitution. Maybe Christy Noem could actually find a career that would be suitable for her. Maybe she could become, I don't know, a bureaucrat, pharmaceutical executive, something like that. Maybe she could sell vaccines in a more direct way. I don't think, as this keeps changing, said one person who was behind the bill to stop the employer mandates. Now, this is a good Republican. His name is Odenbach. And he and John Hansen, so Scott Odenbach and John Hansen, put together the bill that was called the COVID Vaccine Freedom of Conscience Act. And Christy Noem, who has no conscience and who doesn't support freedom, opposed it. And so Odenbach, one of the supporters of that bill, said, I don't think, as this keeps changing, that we should make, force, or coerce people to be guinea pigs. And then he has to do the genuflexes everyone does. Oh, I think the vaccines are good, but I am discouraging coercion. But even that's not good enough for Christy Noem. Odenbach and Hansen argue that the bill should be debated in a special session as soon as possible, given that a number of vaccine mandates will go into effect prior to the regularly scheduled legislative session next January. To call a special session, you need 2/3 of both chambers of the legislature who have to agree, and the governor, however, could call the legislators back for one on her own, but she doesn't support this. And as I said earlier, part of the reason that they're doing this right now, that they're running through this prevarication about approval to encourage people to fire those who do not get vaccinated. One of the reasons that they're running this through right now is because this is time for when a lot of these legislatures are not meeting. Even if it's not a attenuated session, as I pointed out here in Texas, it goes from January to May. And it only meets every other year, I believe. I don't think they're even going to have anything next year. But in South Dakota, they're not going to be back in session until January. Even the people who have longer sessions, they're typically out right about now because they take long vacations around Labor Day. So they run this thing through at the appropriate time to make sure that a lot of stuff is going to happen before any of these legislators react to this. But, of course, they knew it was coming, and they could have done something a long time ago. It's not rocket science to see this is happening. In Mississippi, by Republican Governor Tate Reeves, COVID-positive people in Mississippi are ordered to isolate for 10 days or face up to 5 years in jail. 5 years in jail or $5,000. I'm sorry, $500. $500, let's see, individuals caught flouting the order will be charged $500 and could face imprisonment for 6 months. All people who test positive will isolate for 10 days, but it escalates, and you could get up to 5 years in prison with this. The FDA gives vaccine approval, but a Republican senator asks if it was rushed. And who is that? Is it Rand Paul? No. No, it's not Rand Paul. As a matter of fact, Rand Paul's wife bought into Remdesivir. Oh, yeah. Gilead Pharmaceuticals. Isn't it funny? You know, Gilead Pharmaceutical, the people who are such pals for Anthony Fauci. So who is the Republican senator who really pushed back against this? It's Ron Johnson out of Wisconsin. Ron Johnson is the one who, as I reported 2 months ago, had the former Wisconsin Green Bay Packer football star whose wife, you know, they both got the injection, and you get the same dosage whether you are a 300-pound-plus lineman for the NFL or whether you are a 120-pound, 5-foot wife. You get the same dosage of the protein spikes, the mRNA stuff that makes the protein spikes. She came down with essentially multiple sclerosis. She immediately had issues. They knew what it was, and they've continued to get worse. When nobody would listen to them or pay any attention to them or give them any help, none of the doctors want to know anything about it. Again, it's like that friend of my family's who had an operation, and they left a tool inside of him. And he goes back to the doctor, did the operation. And he could see the tool poking out in his skin. And the doctor looks at it and goes, no, that's not it. No, it's not happening. He just wants to walk away, complete denial. That's the way anybody is about these vaccine side effects. So he put together an organization and of people telling their personal stories about how they have been harmed with this. And Ron Johnson, to his credit, was a part of that. And he took a lot of heat. Yeah, he's been demonized by all the establishment media. And Ron Johnson is the only one who has said that this so-called approval was rushed. He said, "I see no need to rush FDA approval process for any of these COVID vaccines. Expediting the process appears to only serve the political purpose of imposing and enforcing vaccine mandates." He nailed it. This is simply political. It's simply to force and to coerce us with mandates. He said the fast-track decision appeared to be more political than scientific. It skipped all of the usual formal advisory committee meetings. It did not fully account for the reports of deaths and disabilities suffered by people after being vaccinated. We got one senator who will tell the truth about this. Think about that. Not Rand Paul, not Ted Cruz, not Marco Rubio, not Mike Lee, nobody, just Ron Johnson. He stressed that he's not anti-vaccine, but he wants all the usual reviews of safety, effectiveness, and adverse events completed before the stamp of approval. He said, over a year and a half, the decisions of federal health agencies have dramatically affected the lives of all Americans. The impact of these decisions has been felt in Americans' treatment options, in their employment, in their schools, in their housing, in their travel, and in countless other ways. The human toll of the social restrictions and the economic devastation is incalculable. Unfortunately, your federal health agencies have not been transparent with the American people about how these life-altering decisions have been made, or what science or what data they are based upon. I urge you to reconsider your decision to not assemble a VRB PAC public meeting prior to the granting of any final vaccine approval. He wrote that letter to the FDA. The only one to tell the truth about this. You have completely altered every aspect of our lives without any scientific data or justification, review, or transparency. And it's finally time for you to, for once, follow even your own rules and regulations, but they won't do it. And why won't they do it? Because you've got some sellout grifter like Mitch McConnell who says this. Well, the FDA's finally approved the Pfizer vaccine, even further testament to the genius of science and the success of Operation Warp Speed. That guy whose wife, Elaine Chao, you know, Trump gave her the position of the Department of Transportation so she could feed at the trough. He's no better than Pelosi or Schumer or any of these other people, lifetime politicians.
The common man. They created Common Core to dumb down our children. They created Common Pass to track and control us. Their Commons Project to make sure the commoners own nothing. And the communist future. They see the common man as simple, unsophisticated, ordinary. But each of us has worth and dignity created in the image of God. That is what we have in common. That is what they want to take away. Their most powerful weapons are isolation, deception, intimidation. They desire to know everything about us while they hide everything from us. It's time to turn that around and expose what they want to hide. Please share the information and links you'll find at thedavidknightshow.com. Thank you for listening. Thank you for sharing. If you can't support us financially, please keep us in your prayers. TheDavidKnightShow.com.
I want to ask you about some local issues. Culver City Unified School District in California became the first public school district in the U.S. to require vaccinations, not only for teachers and staff, but also for eligible students who are 12 and over. Now that the vaccine has full approval from the FDA, the Pfizer vaccine, would you like to see it mandated for students elsewhere in the U.S.? And once it's approved for kids under 12, should it be mandated for them too?
You know, I know that a lot of people will be pushing back against that, but if you get the imprimatur about the safety and the strong benefit-risk ratio for the children, when that gets established, which I believe it certainly will, by the FDA and the ACIP, I believe that mandating vaccines for children to appear in school is a good idea. And remember, Jake, this is not something new. We have mandates in many places in schools, particularly public schools.
I also don't believe in drugs. For years, I paid my people extra so they wouldn't do that kind of business. Somebody comes to them and says, I have powders. If you put up $3,000, $4,000 investment, we can make $50,000 distributing. So they can't resist. I want to control it as a business, to keep it respectable. I don't want it near schools. I don't want it sold to children. That's an infamia.
You want a child to come in? We've done this for decades and decades, requiring polio, measles, mumps, rubella, hepatitis. So this would not be something new.
They have to get the shot. The vaccinations are so important. This is really going around now. They have to get their shot.
It's true. I have a lot of friends in politics. But they wouldn't be friendly very long if they knew my business was drugs instead of gambling, which they regard as a harmless vice. But drugs is a dirty business.
So here's five lies that they teach your kids in freshman orientation. Number one, white privilege is real. Skin color, this, by the way, is coming from IWF.org. Skin color, they say, is the most important factor about a person on campus. Freshmen coming in undergo various exercises to teach them about privilege. They contend that white male Christians have it the easiest in life. At one freshman orientation at UNC Chapel Hill, it's the university used to be down the street from where he lived. I know about how bad UNC Chapel Hill is. And of course, they've been at the center of, you know, doing gain-of-function research with Fauci as well. At UNC Chapel Hill, white males were cast as villains in skits that aimed to teach inclusion. Yeah, talk to me about inclusion. Lie number two, words are violence. This is to get people to reject the First Amendment, the principles of free speech and free inquiry. See, these are illiberal colleges. I think they should be giving people, instead of a liberal arts degree, they should give them illiberal degrees. Number three, one in five co-eds will be sexually assaulted. I say one of the most oft-repeated higher education stats is that one in five women will be sexually assaulted or raped in college. Yet today it remains a favorite among administrators who basically argue that their campuses are more unsafe for women than urban cities such as Detroit and Chicago. Which I think if that's the case, you ought to get out of there. I'd get out of Detroit and Chicago, and I'd get out of any university that seriously tells you that. Meanwhile, administrators support campus programs that promote promiscuity. Freshman orientation leaders may tout upcoming Sex Week events on campus or even host an experience during Welcome Week. At George Mason University, for example, freshmen attended a sexual chocolate workshop, during which they were advised on how to use chocolate in sex play. This hyper-sexualized theme plays out during the rest of the school year on campuses across the nation, where condoms are doled out like candy, and the abortifacient Plan B is sold in dorm room vending machines. And they have Sex Week events that boast BDSM tutorials. What this reminds me of, and I've talked about this many times, we have seen in pagan cultures the twin deities and festivals of Ashtaroth, which were based on this type of sexual degeneracy. And then, you know, at an appropriate time later, they would have the offerings to Moloch after the unwanted pregnancies showed up. You could pass your baby through the fire, essentially burning them alive. They would have these massive statues that they would heat up very hot, and they would have outstretched arms. You can see pictures of these things online. And they would sacrifice their children alive on that fire. There are places in throughout northern Africa that used to be Carthage, and other places that used to be Philistine areas, where you can see just massive graveyards of babies' skulls where they did that. So you have the promiscuity, followed up by, you know, hey, for your prosperity, you should sacrifice your child. And, of course, these are pagan institutions, aren't they, these colleges? Line number four, gender is a choice. Mm-hmm. And then number five, being colorblind is racist. See, racism is good. That's why I say this is about critical racism teaching. It's not critical racist theory. This is colleges and their racist teachings. That's what CRT is. But now it's trickled down to the lower levels. I want you to hear what a black man says about critical race theory in one of these school hearings.
I am the direct descendant of the North American slave trade. On my mother's side, my ancestors were enslaved in Alabama. On my father's side, we were enslaved in Texas. I am not oppressed. I'm not oppressed, and I'm not a victim.
Standing ovation.
I'm neither oppressed nor a victim. I travel all across this country of ours, and I check into hotels, and I fly commercially, and I walk into retail establishments, and I order food in restaurants. I go wherever I want, whenever I want. I am treated with kindness, dignity, and respect, literally from coast to coast. I have three children. They are not oppressed either. Although they are victims, I've taught my children they are victims of three things: their own ignorance, their own laziness, and their own poor decision making. That is all. My children, we are not victims of America. We are not victims of some unseen 190-year-old force that kind of floats around in the ether. Putting critical race theory into our classrooms is taking our nation in the wrong direction. Racism in America would by and large be dead today if it were not for certain people and institutions keeping it on life support. And sadly, very sadly, one of those institutions is the American education system. I can think of nothing more damaging to a society than to tell a baby born today that she has grievances against another baby born today simply because of what their ancestors may have done two centuries ago. There is simply no point in doing that to our children, and putting critical race theory into our classrooms in part does that. Putting critical race theory into our classrooms is not combating racism, it's fanning the flames of what little embers are left. I encourage you to support this resolution. Let racism die the death it deserves, and let's keep living the life of the country that we are. Thank you.
Really well said. Really well said.
Their job is to teach our kids math, science, biology, literature, and that's it, not ideology.
Unfortunately, that's what many people think. Our schools are doing precisely what they were designed to do. And I've had this discussion with people for decades. Why can't Johnny read, we used to say. They don't even pretend to care anymore. As a matter of fact, they want to shut down all measurement of that, as I reported last week. Our schools were never designed. That's what parents want from a school. Never confuse what you want from an institution or from a politician with what they want to do. See, that's the key thing. We project onto them the idea that since this is a good thing, they would buy into this. We tend to think that people are basically good. That is not a view that was shared by the founders of this country, because they were coming from a perspective of Christians who understand that people are not basically good. We're basically evil. As Madison said, because we're not angels, we need to have government. Because government is made up of people, we have to keep a careful eye on that. As Patrick Henry said, guard anyone with suspicion who comes close to the precious jewel of liberty, right? But we become very naive about this. And we tend to think that because we would never put together a system where we would deliberately try to rip people off or to try to enslave them or to try to put them under a permanent prison system, take everything that they have, or even from the standpoint, this is how, as I've mentioned before, how people like Ted Bundy are able to succeed. You know, here's a attractive, very sociable person. Women just couldn't believe that he would rape and kill them. And we keep getting raped and killed worldwide by these political leaders because we can't understand that they're Ted Bundys. Exhibit A is QAnon Trump. So you have to have a little bit of understanding about what this is all about. These people are not there to educate your kids. They're there to deliberately dumb you down. Read Charlotte Isherby's book from 40 years ago if you want to know what the educational institutions are about. It'll be a wake-up call to you. And then you can also go back and take a look at the people of the early 20th century, the 19th century, people like Horace Mann, people after him, like Thomas Dewey, who gave us the Dewey Decimal System, but he also gave us this horrific institution that is now producing what you see on the streets of Seattle and Portland. They had an agenda, and it was not to make kids critical thinkers or to give them facts or anything like that. We need to understand that. We need to stop arguing with these people. They're never going to obey the Constitution. They're not going to obey the law. They're going to do what they want. And they have values that they hold very strongly. And if we hold our values strongly, we will get our kids out of these institutions and then shut these things down.
The Common Man. They created Common Core to dumb down our children. They created Common Pass to track and control us. Their Commons Project to make sure the commoners own nothing. And the communist future. They see the common man as simple, unsophisticated, ordinary. But each of us has worth and dignity created in the image of God. That is what we have in common. That is what they want to take away. Their most powerful weapons are isolation, deception, intimidation. They desire to know everything about us while they hide everything from us. It's time to turn that around and expose what they want to hide. Please share the information and links you'll find at thedavidknightshow.com. Thank you for listening. Thank you for sharing. If you can't support us financially, please keep us in your prayers. TheDavidKnightShow.com.